Right. Did Ted Walter make it? And when is he scheduled to?
Okay. So welcome everyone to the July 28th, 2021 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference. Craig, take the role again.
Yeah. Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, Ann Hendrick, Sheila Casey, Barry Zwicker, Bonnie Faulkner, Jane Milliken, Kat McGuire, Sherry Aspen, Damon Issei, David Cole, next page, Elizabeth Rendon. Is that the right name?
That's my number, actually.
William, that's your name. Number. Okay. Yeah. Right. Sorry. William. Yes. William Rodriguez, Fern Tishman, Jane Clark, Joe Baltar, John O'Malley, Carl Golovin, Kathy Allard, Lynn Cornelison, Al Magaletta, Malcolm Arnold, and we're in the home stretch here, Marty Hopper, Nita Renfrew, Peter Ketchum, Richard Gage, and Roland Engel.
I sent him an email, but he's not looking at his email, so I don't know how to...
Sorry, I couldn't make out what that...
It sounds like someone's trying to talk on speakerphone. It's hard to hear you. You're too far away.
Yeah, yeah, it is hard on the speaker.
Okay, I don't know who that was. There is an anonymous, Craig, if you look on the...
That's Sheila. That's Sheila.
Oh, that's Sheila.
We have this every month.
Oh, that's
every month.
Okay.
That's Sheila. So I think we're good to start, Cheryl.
Okay, just one second here.
Craig, quick question. Is Ted Walter here, and is he scheduled to speak at what time?
He is scheduled to speak. He's going to come on at the end when the first speaker is finished. So I'm gonna give him a heads up sort of shortly before he's supposed to come on. So he's prepared for that, but it'll be after 9 p.m. Eastern at some point when Ted will come on.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So just the minutes for last month are not prepared because Craig had trouble getting the recording off of Free Conference Call and onto his own computer. So and then he sends it to Ann, and Ann goes through and makes up the minutes. So we'll be approving those next month instead of this month. And also,
yeah, it's actually, Cheryl, it wasn't a problem getting it onto my computer. It was getting it onto my website, uploading it onto the website from the computer. That's I was having trouble. It wasn't working. So that's, I'll sort that out for next month, and we can, like you said, we can approve both tonight and last month. Then, yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, and then the other thing, Mark Crispin Miller, who was supposed to be on last month, emailed me after the next day and said he had a bad thunderstorm and he didn't have any power, and so he couldn't access the numbers or anything. So that's why he didn't join us. I asked him for this month, and he said he couldn't, but he wants to do it in the future, so we'll try and line him up for next month. So that's still in the works there. Okay, so the agenda that we sent out has now been altered slightly with Willie's request to go first and introduce a surprise guest for a few minutes. Does anyone object to that? And does anyone object to the agenda in addition to adding Willie? Okay, hearing no objections, then everything is approved, and let's start. So, Willie, thank you for joining us, and please take it away.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for the opportunity. It's been a long time, and I haven't been in one of the meetings, and I wanted to say hello to each one of you. And I have a big news that I wanted to share with everybody so you can make use of it in a positive way. One of the things is, I have several projects coming up, huge productions coming up, which is good, all related to the story of, my survival and all what I did on 9/11, but also my work as an activist. And during that process, I contacted somebody that owns CameraPlanet.com. You all remember that website, which it has all the videos about 9/11 that many people use for different productions. The owner is Steven Rosenbaum. Steven is not only, you can find him on the internet, on YouTube, on Tech Talks. He's an expert on media archiving and all of that. And he's the biggest donor of media for the 9/11 Museum on Ground Zero. He has donated 500 hours of archival footage and audio from what happened on 9/11. He did that as an exchange that they will allow him to record and film, make a film, during 7 years that it took him, about the whole process of creating the museum, the memorial. And he actually finished it. It's called The Outsider, and it's a very powerful film that is coming out August 19th. Now, Stephen has been given two huge articles on the New York Times last week. Two different articles, which is a very rare thing to get on the New York Times. It was on the New York Daily News last Monday, and he's been on NBC and Good Morning America, I think it was. And because the museum wants to stop the film. They want to stop the film because it's critical in many ways to what the process was inside the museum. They got seven lawyers trying to stop now the release of the video. But what Stephen has done, he has presented very, very powerfully the quest of the truth of what happened on 9/11 in a very subtle manner. And he wants to be able to give activists the opportunity to see the film before it goes out. And I'm going to introduce him now, but he will like to set up either another agenda through Zoom, so everybody, only activists, please, not anybody that is not related to 9/11 activism, to be able to see it before it's released. Let me introduce Stephen Rosenbaum. Go ahead, Stephen.
Willie, thank you so much, and very much appreciate the introduction. I'll just say one thing about the film. The film has no agenda. We're not pro-truthers. We're not anti-truthers. We're not pro-families. We're not anti-families. We're not pro-museum. We're not anti-museum. What we are is pro-access to conversation and free speech. And the footage that we have of demonstrators on September 11th in the many years while we were there, I just watched people being marginalized. And, you know, I think that the questions you're raising, and I don't mean individually, you all have different feelings, as do I, but we should have a right to have those conversations in public. And as I'm sure you've all experienced, the museum's control of the day of 9/11 is so absolute and so non-negotiable. You can't walk on the site and speak your mind. You can't go down in the museum and take a picture. You can't access the archives. So our footage, which we donated so that you guys would have access to it to do research, they won't let you have it. And we think that's wrong. So what I'm going to, I'll give you my email address. I'm not going to bug you. And the other thing is, everything you say to me, everything you say in the screenings, is off the record. We're not looking for quotes. We're not looking for interview subjects. The film is done. The film is finished. And there will be pieces in it that you will have very strong feelings about. And I won't paraphrase it, because you'll either want to watch it or you won't. But my email address is steve@magnifymedia.com. And the film's website is, yeah, of course, Steve, S-T-E-V-E, at magnifymedia.com. And perhaps an easier way to reach me is the film's website is theoutsider.film. And on that site, you'll see clips from the film. You'll see the background of the film that's been made. And there's also a way to reach, if you reach out to the press link, you'll reach me. We're going to schedule two times next week. One will be during the day, one will be in the evening, and the film is 83 minutes. We'll do it on Zoom. We'll ask you not to screen record, please. But, you know, we all know that can be done. We hope you won't. The censorship that we've experienced from the museum is, it's threatening, it's mean-spirited, it's dangerous, And the question I would ask all of you, just as kind of a starting point for our screenings next week, is where did this name National come from? Who named them a national museum? It's privately funded and privately owned and privately controlled. There's no democracy there. And the only reason it's called the National 9/11 Memorial Museum is because they claim that title. But, you know, there, you know, you, none of you are on the advisory board. None of you are part of the discussion about what the museum it, there's. And what's interesting is, as I start speaking to people, lots of the family members are very angry at the museum. Lots of Muslim Americans are very angry at the museum. I don't know who they represent, but they don't represent me. So I hope you'll join the screening.
No, they don't represent the truth, Steve. That's the bottom line. It's their agenda. You know, they're trying to stifle you.
Well, and what would be interesting is if it were clearly a place of discussion and exploration, then you would all be welcome there. And you would be invited in, and there'd be conversations, and there'd be debate and dialogue, and that would be fascinating. And I'd love to hear from all of you. And, you know, it's not about changing people's minds. It's about educating people.
I may add, I'm sorry, William Rodriguez here. I may add, I'm sorry, Stephen. This film will explain to you why they have this historical, apparently historical process when you go in all the way to the moment that you go out, and you don't have the story of the last man out. You don't have the story of Willie Rodriguez nowhere in there. You see? Why? Because it will open a can of worms. If they allow my story to go in, they have to let all the stories of other people that experience what I experience inside the museum, and that will open a whole Pandora's box. Go ahead.
But here's the good news. It's been 20 years. This is the appropriate anniversary to start to actually get change to happen there. And I'm very optimistic that together we're going to raise these issues to a level where the museum won't be able to ignore. Individually, they can ignore all of us. Individually, they can ignore all of you and all of the family members and all of the, you know, very angry firefighters, it turns out. But collectively, the disappointment in what they built, you know, it's leaving average Americans without an honest view of the truth. So I won't take any more of your time. Thank you for letting me jump to the agenda. Please either go to the website or email me or reach out to Willie if you lose my email.
Willie, this is Cheryl. Willie, can you email Craig and let him know what times those airings are coming up this week, and we'll put it out to the group?
Okay,
absolutely.
I'll make the two different times that Stephen will give me, and we can send you the link for the Zoom meeting, and everybody can go in.
Well, I mean, to be clear, it's going to be password protected, and we're going to want to. I mean, much like you do at the beginning of your call, we're not opposed to having other points of view, but we want the individual screenings for people to feel safe, and so we're not going to let strangers in.
Okay.
That's why you have to be activist only. That's why I said only people that are, you know, in the movement as activists is what matters here. So I will do that, and I will send you guys if my email is WTCBill, World Trade Center, BILL, @gmail.com.
So WTCBill @gmail.com.
Yes.
Okay, great.
I'm, and by the way, just so you know, there may be things in the film you don't. There may be things in the film you don't like. There may be things you disagree with. We are open to hearing those things as well. We're not looking for platitudes.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. But I honestly saw the film, and I was happily amazed by it, but I was very angry, not because of any portrayals, because the people, there's a lot of truthers there. You see it, but it's not critical about them, which is powerful, because if this goes mainstream, like it's going to be, I mean, like I said, you know, the push by the New York Times is being huge. And it's going to be released on August 19th. So it's going to create a lot of buzzwords out there. But
we have a distribution announcement. I just can't make it yet. But it's a big, it's global.
Okay. It's global. And is this film going to be for sale? Is the film for sale? Like for individual people?
So you'll be able, on September 3rd, it'll be on iTunes, Google Play, and Amazon Video Direct, and they'll all have a rental version and a purchase version.
Okay, great. All right. All right, well, thank
By the
you
way,
very much.
I'm not part of the film. I don't even show up on the film, so don't think that I have a quested interest in it.
I met you 10 days ago. You reached out. Yes. I appreciate it. All right, I'm going to jump off.
Guys.
Thank you, everybody. All right.
Okay, great. Thank you both of you. Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Okay, guys. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thanks, William. Thanks, Steve.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. Well, and thank you, Damon, for letting us in and being willing to go a little bit later in your presentation.
Well, it's all very important, and I'm really into 9/11, too, so that's certainly not an issue.
Okay, great. All right, so right now, then we're going to get on to our next speaker, who is Damon Isay. I got that right. And Ann Hendricks is going to introduce him. So, Ann, please go ahead.
Cheryl, you want to put this in lecture mode, eh?
Yes, I'm looking at my computer. All right, let me unmute Ann.
Yeah. Because I could tell we were having some noise problems with the last one. Yeah.
Okay, Ann, you're unmuted, and let's make sure we have Damon unmuted too. Okay, there we go. Okay, Ann, go ahead.
Sure. Damon's aviation interests and career have spanned more than 40 years. After earning his private pilot's rating in 1977, he went on to receive the ratings of a commercial pilot, instrument pilot, and flight instructor. Southern New England-based, many of his training flights were flown to Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket under both visual and instrument flight conditions. He worked for the state of Rhode Island as an airport attendant and traffic advisor at the North Central State Airport. He's founding father of the Quonset Air Museum and served as the president, organization's president for many years. In 1994, he led the salvage team that recovered a U.S. Navy F-6F Hellcat off the waters of Martha's Vineyard. As an local aviation professional, Damon was solicited by the Providence Journal shortly after the death of John Kennedy Jr. and his wife Carolyn and her sister Lauren. Damon, why don't you take it from there, and thank you very much for presenting tonight.
Sure. I think I'm going to dispense with a lot of the fluff stuff, to which I think we're all very aware that John was headed on a political career, and he was definitely aiming towards the presidency. And rather than spend a whole lot of time on that, I'd rather get into the aviation aspects that really speak to the evidence of foul play and a great deal of dishonesty on the parts of the reporting authorities. But John was obsessed with aviation from the day that he was born. When he was a three-year-old kid in the White House, hanging out with his father, he'd welcome the helicopters every time they came in, and he'd jump in and he'd play with all the stuff. As a matter of fact, when he was, he was about 9 or 10, his mother actually got him an old stripped-out Piper Cub and laid it out for him, and he used to go in there and pretend that he was a pilot. So aviation was pretty much instilled in him. You know, this is besides the fact that he got a law degree, and everybody faults him because it took him 3 shots at it, but I wish that I could have passed a law, a bar exam in 3 attempts. So let's have a look at what John did. John did a lot of ultralight training before he actually got into the pilot's license thing. And he had at least 200 hours of flying hang gliders and ultralights through 1982. He had 46 hours of dual. Dual means that he was flying with an instructor. He had 1 hour of solo from 1982 through 1988. Jackie got terrified when John was taking the flight lessons because she began having dreams. that he was going to die in a plane crash, and he promised her that he would fly no more. Jackie died on May 19th, 94, and John resumed his flight training in December of 97, and he departs for Flight Service International, which is a Florida-based outfit, and he logs 43 hours of dual and 10 hours of solo, and he gets his private license. He buys a Cessna 182 November 529, John Kennedy, JK. He logs 65 hours of dual and 114 hours of solo during 8 months, and so he's averaging 5.5 hours per week. He passes his instrument written exam on March 12th, 1999, with a 78% score. And I have to testify to this. The instrument exam, the instrument written, is the toughest exam you'll ever take in your life. And to walk away with something better than a 75 is really doing something. In fact, when I took mine, I did a 75, so he beat me by 3 points. And then he returned down to Flight Service International on April 5th, 1999. He received 13.3 hours of dual instrument flight training, 17 hours of simulator flight training, and he left Flight Service again on April 24th, and he bought the Saratoga that everyone was killed in November 9, 2, 3, 5, and November. Three different CFIs, logged 96 hours of dual with him in that airplane, including 17 hours of night flight and 8 hours of actual instrument. He received his complex endorsement. Now, the complex endorsement is a whenever you move up, you move up in a grade when you're flying airplanes, you need an endorsement, which essentially means that you fly with a check pilot, he checks you out, he writes it in your logbook, and you're good to go. Normally, an endorsement like this for the airplane, the airplane that he was transitioning into, he went from a fixed gear airplane into a retractable gear airplane with a constant speed prop. A constant speed prop is an adjustable pitch propeller. Okay, so this is what determines the complex part of the aircraft. He has an adjustable pitch propeller and he has retractable gear. Okay, normally insurance companies only require 10.5 hours of transition time before they'll underwrite you. So he was well within those limits. Okay, when I first noticed, and all these figures were taken actually from the National Transportation Safety Board report, which sort of hangs itself if you really get into it, because the report is relatively ambiguous, because they'll say one thing in one spot and then something somewhere else. And they were definitely in the cover-up. But from the professional perspective, when I look at his flight training, everything was nice and tight and consolidated. Recency of experience is everything. And when your flight training is consolidated, like playing guitar, like learning anything else, you know, you're into a building block sort of learning pattern. And this is the best way that anybody could possibly be trained. Okay, when we look at his total time as his pilot credentials, now they made it sound like, and you hear all the stories that you heard, is he wasn't licensed to be doing what he was doing. He didn't file a flight plan. He was inexperienced. The airplane got away from him. He had complex navigational equipment that he wasn't ready for. These are all lies. Okay, these are all lies. John had sufficient time. He was a conscientious pilot. Everybody that flew with him testified to the fact that he was meticulous and right on the nail with everything that he did. So what we know about his flight time totals, in dual with instructors, we know he had 250 hours, minimal. Okay, solo flight time, we know he had 125 hours minimal, and I suspect it's far greater than that. Because if you start counting the hang glider time and the ultralight time and the time that wasn't recorded, because they never recovered his final flight log. Well, they recovered it, but they absconded it and they took off with it. But the logbook was in a blue flight attaché case that he had with him. That washed up on the shore. The police grabbed it, and that was the last anybody ever saw of it. And the FAA and the NTSB claimed that they never saw it, and they have no idea what his final hours were. And I just see that as being another smokescreen. It's just a pile of bull. So we got 250 hours of dual time, 125 hours minimal solo time, and I would guess that that's more like 350 to 400 hours solo time. He had 38.3 hours minimal instrument time. Now, you can get your instrument rating at 40 hours. The average is 40 to 45 hours, but John certainly had enough time here that he could have gotten himself into any kind of a, he could have gotten himself out of any kind of a hot water situation. And we're trained from day one, from day one. If you get in trouble, you call for help. John was never able to get that call out, but we'll address that a little bit later. Okay, but he was more than qualified. I had about as much time as he did in instrument training, and you have to check weather before you take off in an airplane. If you're not on record with the FAA as having checked weather, it's the first question they ask you, and you'll be fined immediately if they don't pull your license if you haven't checked weather. And I forget the point I was trying to make with that, but we'll just move right on. He had 40 hours minimal of nighttime flying, and he had 96 hours minimum complex time. All right, so he's well over all of the qualifications that he needed to fly his airplane. Everything else was just pure baloney. The stories about his instruments being way ahead of him and he wasn't ready for them. He didn't have a big complex autopilot. It's all snuff. It's all soap. It's ridiculous. He had a single axis autopilot. It's very simple. It's just one button, the heading button, and you turn it to get a heading to go somewhere, and the airplane just turns left or right to bring you there. It's just that simple. All right, so we have 450 hours that are on record, not including the ultralight time. Keep in mind now, only 250 hours are required for commercial certification. All right, so he was essentially 200 hours beyond the time necessary for a commercial pilot, which is, that's a lot of time. Airlines would start looking at you if you had about 700 hours. So he could have been a flight instructor in a heartbeat with the time that he had. The first thing that really caught my, let me tell you how I got into this to begin with. Ann had said, I was contacted by the Providence Journal to make a comment about the crash, and I'm a commercial fisherman, or I was, by trade. I had come in from a day's fishing, and the guy called me for comment, and I just made a boilerplate comment because I had no reason to doubt the official story. And I just said that, you know, I had been in and out of the island lots of times with students, by myself, on a date, you name it. I had always been in and out of there, and you really have to be on your game, because if the weather comes in, you're flying over the coast. If you get closed in, you can get in trouble. And I made a statement pretty much to that effect. I never really thought about it again. And then I started getting into JFK assassination research about 10 years ago. I was going through my closet, I came across the newspaper article, and I read it, and I said, you know, you never even checked weather before making this statement, and it really, really bothered me. So in my experiences working the tower at North Central, I also became a certified weather observer, and I was very aware that every airfield, or every major airfield anyway, has a precision instrument that log the weather on the hourly basis and gives you really incredible detail as to what's going on in the field once an hour. This is on record once every hour. And it took me a long time to actually get to the archives because they were so old by that time, but I finally got to them, and sure enough, when I started looking at the hourly readings, it just something made absolutely no sense, because what happened was John left the worst weather in Essex, New Jersey, where he took off, and he flew into the best weather at Martha's Vineyard. They were reporting 4 miles visibility down in Essex, New Jersey when he left, and it got increasingly better as he flew over to Martha's Vineyard. Now, all the reports that you see that initially came out, all the releases from the Navy, from Associated Press, all of those people, all indicated that he was flying out over Long Island and then made this giant jump from the end of Long Island over open ocean out to Martha's Vineyard. Okay, that's absolutely incorrect, and you'll see diagram after diagram. In fact, one was so bad that they even took him out south of Long Island into open ocean and put him out towards Martha's Vineyard, which no one in his right mind would ever do. Okay, now any of these resources could have just gone to the NTSB report, which spells it all out. Now what John did, which is the absolute normal flight pattern out of that area, excuse me, he left Essex, he made a northerly turn towards Tappan Zee Bridge. That's usually the route that we take. Then you make a right at the Tappan Zee Bridge, and you follow the Connecticut coastline all the way down, Connecticut into Rhode Island, and usually make the transition somewhere over by New Bedford or Horseshoe Beach, which would allow you to pass over the Elizabethans, even en route to Martha's Vineyard. So it would give you, every pilot who flies at night would be looking for any out that he possibly could, because we try not to depend on an engine. You know, you don't know when you're going to lose an engine. So John's choice of routes was absolutely exactly what he should have been doing. And following that coastline, if he had lost an engine or he had a problem with the airplane, even though it was nighttime, he could have made a beach. He could have made Route 95, and he would have had all of those outs. And that was precisely what John did. Okay, and the truth never ever really got out about that. But I'll just run some numbers past you so that you can get an idea of what was going on. I've got the hourly field observations here, and I interpolated the time at which he passed each one of these airports, okay, and the conditions at those airports at the moment that he went over the top of them, which is essentially what he did all the way. All right, when he left Caldwell, they were reporting visibility of 5 miles, wind was southwest at 5.8, which is, for the most part, we call that light and variable. Humidity was only 41%. It wasn't that high, and I think that reading is erroneous, because I think the humidity was much, much higher than that. The next airport that we recorded that he passed over was KBDR is Sikorsky, which is down around New Haven. And they were reporting 4 miles visibility. Wind was west-southwest, 11.5 knots. But we see the humidity is at 78% there. And I don't see a 30-plus difference between there and Caldwell. So I think the original reading at Caldwell was not correct. Dew point and temperature spread was about 8 or 9 points, which wasn't too bad. So it seems it's pretty accurate. Then the next airport that we logged in was Groton. Okay, that's the next one up. And when he got to Groton, he had a visibility of 7.5 miles. Wind west-southwest, 5.8. 69% relative humidity. So you can see these humidity figures are relatively close all the way down. He passed over New Bedford, and when he passed over New Bedford, he had 7 miles visibility. Humidity was 79%. The spread was 5.9 on the temperature and the dew point, so he had a sufficient margin there. When he arrived at Martha's Vineyard, they were reporting, or I should say at 9:30 when he went in, they were reporting 9 miles visibility, which is very good. 10 miles and better is always considered really good flying for a pilot. 9 miles visibility, dew point temperature spread was 9 points, which is very healthy. 73% relative humidity, wind speed was only 10 knots. The tower manager is on record as saying that the visibilities that night were better than were reported in the official reports that came out. And he's on record saying that he was talking to airplanes that were 10 to 15 miles out, and he could see their lights. Just to, for my own satisfaction, I went one step further and went out to Nantucket, which is another 15 miles out to sea, another 15, 20 miles out to sea. I wanted to see what was going on there because Nantucket's always the first one to go down. But at 9:53, and John now and his passengers have already been in the water for half an hour, at 9:53, Nantucket was still reporting a visibility of 4 miles, which is still VFR, still visual flight rules. The dew point and temperature only had a one-point spread, so things were starting to deteriorate. But Nantucket didn't go full instrument until after midnight that night. Okay, so Martha's Vineyard was in the clear the entire time. At 9:39 p.m. Friday, Kennedy radioed the airport and said he was 13 miles from the airport and 10 miles from the coast, according to WCBB-TV News in Boston. He reportedly said he was making his final approach. In his final approach message, CBB-TV said Kennedy told controllers at the airport that he planned to drop off his wife's sister and then take off again between 11 and 11:30 for Hyannis. And he was headed there for his cousin Rory's wedding. The reason he was off late to begin with, and there's been a lot of talk about this, because John was seen on the phone, and some of you may have heard this if you studied his story at all, but he was pacing back and forth at the FBO. The FBO is the flight operations there at Essex Airport. Pacing back and forth, he was nervous, he was making a ton of phone calls, and what had happened was Carolyn was tied up. He had already picked up Lauren. They were waiting for Carolyn at the airport. He just wanted to get going. And she was busy getting her nails done at a boutique in downtown New York. She was extremely fussy about this. And she actually had cut a piece of fabric out of the gown she was wearing for the wedding. And her manicurist, or I should say the pedicurist, because she was getting a pedicure, pedicurist had to redo her toenail polish 3 times before she was satisfied with the color. And while she was sitting there getting done, she was having these conversations with John where he'd call her every 15 minutes and say, "Where are you? We got to get going here." And finally, she, I don't want to say she blew her stack, but she got upset and she said, "Look, quit calling me. Let me get done and then I'll get there." Okay? So that was the reason that they took off at 8:30 rather than 6:30. There's a lot of talk that he was trying to call a flight instructor because a flight instructor was supposed to make the flight with him. And they say that there are theories that claim that there was a Manchurian candidate flight instructor that actually sabotaged the airplane. And the evidence that they use for that is the fact that they never recovered the right front passenger seat, like they disposed of the body and the flight instructor in one shot. But I found absolutely no evidence to support that theory, and there's a lot of beef behind it. There's a lot of people that really think that that's what went down, but it is certainly not the case. He didn't need the flight instructor. He didn't need the flight plan. He didn't need help. He was completely qualified. Now, we're going to tell you a little story about Adam Budd. Adam Budd was the nicest fella, and he was a summertime intern at Martha's Vineyard, and he was there the night that John was supposed to arrive. Now, he tells us, let me just jump to the next screen here for you. Okay, he gave me a critical timeline. I was very lucky to find him because he's in all the original accounts. But he was a ghost, and he was hard to get a hold of, and I finally dug him up, and I asked him if I could interview him, and he said I could, and I was just tickled to death with that. But apparently at 1:30 in the afternoon, John called Martha's Vineyard Operations, and he informed them of an anticipated arrival at 7:30. He wanted a tie-down space while he was, or a place to park the airplane while he was letting out Lauren. And he didn't expect to leave until later on. Carolyn, at 6:30, Carolyn was still having her nails done at the New York boutique. 8:15, they had a late departure from Essex, New Jersey. At 10 o'clock, Adam discovers a couple with child waiting for John. And they said the estimated time of arrival was between 8:30 and 9:30. So at 10:01, Adam calls the control tower, which is in the process of shutting down for the night, and the tower claims it has no info on his airplane whatsoever. At 10:05, Adam gets a little more concerned, and he calls Bridgeport Flight Service to see what they might know, and he received absolutely no cooperation from them. They were belligerent with him. Adam felt put off by the person he spoke with, but did not pursue the matter. He's just a kid there doing a summer job, and Adam specifically states that Kennedy Jr. is on board. But still, absolutely no avail, and they said they knew absolutely nothing. Go away, kid. Who do you think you are? And I have never, ever known flight service to act this way. This is very, very atypical. If you're concerned about an airplane's arrival, they would do everything to help you. So I suspect the hush had already been put in at that point. Now, we already know that he's missing, okay? The Bridgeport Flight Service have been called, and they've been told that he is missing. But we don't start search and rescue, which was executed by the Coast Guard after family members were going crazy. They didn't start searching for the airplane until 2:05 a.m. Billy Clinton claims he knew nothing until 5 o'clock in the morning, and I find that completely unbelievable. But he claims he knew nothing until 5 o'clock in the morning, and they woke him up, and that's when he came out with the Reagan line, and he said, well, you tell those guys if they don't find him, they better start looking for a new job tomorrow. Okay, but we're going to get into the POTUS orders now that really affected what went on here. At 6:30 a.m., the authority for the search and rescue was stripped from the hands of the Coast Guard and handed to the Pentagon. And in an unprecedented move, the U.S. Air Force becomes the official search agency in charge. I cannot tell you how out of the normal this is, and this is something that is just totally never done. This is not done, okay? But this is, right now, they're controlling, they're beginning to control the spin on the whole thing, and that's essentially what I see happening. Now, my conversations with Adam, this is precisely what he told me about the conditions at the field that night. He said the visibility was good. There was a very thin fog directly on the grass. He said he could see the stars overhead. He could see the entire periphery of the airport, and it was visible to the eye. He couldn't recall any aircraft movement after 10 p.m., but he took off at 10:30 and went out. He was partying with friends. He closed up shop. He went out. He came in for the morning shift, and the island was already buzzing with the press. Adam was questioned by the press, and he spoke innocently and honestly with members of the press prior to the hush order. Adam was fired 1 week later for violating the hush order. Adam received a thank you call from Ted Kennedy for trying to execute a search effort. He left the island and returned to Bridgewater, where his father died on August 10th, and he never really gave the disappearance of John and his family much more thought. And he still buys the official story and thinks that they just got into trouble. Or his quote to me, he didn't seem like the most intelligent guy in the world, if I may be frank. And for someone who has a pilot's rating, and he's worked for Delta Airlines for years, but he's not a commercial pilot. He's somewhere in the office. But he had relatively little flight knowledge, and he said, well, you know, he and his wife, they got in a fight or something, and he just augured in. And I don't know. I just really wasn't impressed with the guy. I mean, I wouldn't publish that, but he didn't seem to really have his act together. But regardless of that, you know, his observations are what they are. He was a pilot, so he knows what to look for, and obviously the field was reachable. Now, another thing that I'm certain John would have done, because we all take advantage of this, they have a flight service offers something that's called flight watch, which is sort of like having a flight plan, but not with the rigid formality of a flight plan. Essentially, when an airplane takes off and is going somewhere, they'll call the controller and they'll say, I'd like to have flight watch because I'm going out over the water. Keep an eye on me until I get out to Martha's Vineyard. And I would be nearly certain that John would use that service, but there's no mention of flight watch anywhere. So this is Adam's quote, actually. This is his conversation with the air traffic controller. Actually, Kennedy Jr. is on board, sir. He's says their family want to know where he is. And Adam generally performed clerical tasks, and he took landing fees, assisted travelers with ground transportation and other needs. When the operator told him that he wouldn't give him the information over the phone, Bud backed off, and he says, okay, well, if it's too much trouble, I'll just have him wait. It's not a big deal. And he said that in the end, it probably wouldn't have helped anything but a description of the wreckage, and you can bet on that. It doesn't seem like it would have mattered. And then Adam said to the newspapers, it sounds like they're going to fire me, but I'll find out. And sure enough, within a week, they canned him, and the airport manager had absolutely no comment about any of it. So the first thing that happens now is the Federal Aviation Administration begins to backpedal. And these are the quotes, actually, from the NTSB report and other sources. Several aviation experts and the FAA said the agency acted appropriately. An FAA spokesman said the agency does not provide any information on private citizens and private aircraft over the telephone, and that the call from Bud gave no indication of any serious problem. Now, how did the call from Bud not give any indication of a serious problem? He's telling the controller that the airplane is overdue, and they're worried about the pilot, and that's John Kennedy Jr. So how many alerts do they need? How many wake-up calls do they need on the end of that telephone receiver? Okay. And we wish very much that we had more information, but we had nothing to indicate that the plane was overdue or that it was in trouble. That's Elliot Brenner, the FAA spokesman, who was called on to speak for it. So now the AOPA and MIT chime in, and the AOPA is the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. I'll just read a few quotes there. A plane that landed intact could typically float about 15 minutes or so. A plane that breaks apart would sink much faster, said John Hansman, an aeronautics professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Okay, no miracle there. First question is, was it a survivable crash? If it was survivable, it would have potentially made a difference, but it doesn't appear that the FAA really did anything inappropriate. Now, who's this guy from MIT to be making comments about what's appropriate with the FAA and what isn't? It's completely ridiculous. He has no business even speaking. In 99% of the cases, when someone is reported overdue, they're safe on the ground somewhere and just not where people expected them to be. In a world of private aviation, it's extremely common for a plane to be an hour or two late, said Drew Stachetti, Senior Vice President of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. So these guys are all jumping in, rendering their opinions based upon the official story. Okay, well, I'm going through the PowerPoint right now. I'm going through the various slides that show that his path was out over Long Island, which it wasn't. We know he was nowhere near Long Island. But the reason that they did this was because the next morning they executed a fake search over a Horton Point, which is out near Montauk, and they kept airplanes there for 15 to 20 hours. When they already knew that his airplane went in over near the island. They already had it on NTAP results with the radar. So the Air Force executes a phony search nowhere near the vicinity of the crash. Nowhere near. Okay, I'm flipping through some screens on there. Okay, here we go. So we got the official Air Force spokesman is a guy named Steve Rourke. Lieutenant Steve Rourke was asked why his search was scattered all over the Atlantic when the NTAP report was available 8 hours earlier, pinpointing the exact location of the crash. He said he would continue on the same track, stating that we have nothing that absolutely pinpoints to one area as opposed to another, so we can't rule out the entire flight. When asked again about the radar position of the crash site, Rourke lied and said it was just a possible position. Linda Killian from People magazine questioned Lieutenant Steve Warwick, the director of the U.S. Air Force School of National Rescue, Search and Rescue School, at the time former director of Air Force Rescue Coordination Center. I'm sorry, this is a mouthful, but this is the credentials that this guy's got. So she's questioning him on TV about the time discrepancy regarding official notification of the missing plane. And instead of getting an answer, she got raw, uninterrupted static, where obviously Steve Rourke just hung up the phone on the other end, didn't bother to answer her call. She got cut off, the question never got answered and never got asked again, never got mentioned in any media outlet. Okay, everyone claims that John got progressively disoriented and got himself into a graveyard spiral, which eventually got worse. Graveyard spiral means the airplane begins to bank, gets ahead of the pilot, and eventually does a spiral down into the sea. That has absolutely not happened. What happened with John, there is nothing to indicate any of that. John went from straightforward flight to straight down in a matter of about 2.5 seconds. Okay, it was bam, and he was just headed straight down. Okay, and he wasn't just straight down, he was even negative to perpendicular, if you can. So it was, the airplane went in slightly inverted. Okay, at no time during this whole process was John able to call out a distress call. Okay, so something happened in that cockpit that knocked him silly. There is only one thing that will cause an airplane to go and dive in like that, okay? But the theorists will go and they'll tell you, they say, well, this is where the Manchurian flight instructor came in. He just shoved that stick forward, and that airplane went augering in, all right? It, totally ridiculous. John would have punched him in the head 3 or 4 times, regained control of the aircraft. Now, not just that. You can't just push a stick forward and the airplane goes straight in. What happens is once you get that stick forward and the airplane gains airspeed, lift begins to work on the wings again, and that stick will push, or I should say the yoke, steering wheel, will push back on the pilot. In order for that pilot to have drilled in the way that John went, you'd have to stick your foot up on the stick to hold it there, because that's the kind of back pressure you would be getting fighting the attitude. All right, so he went 2,500 feet in about 1 minute, less than that. He hit the water. Essentially, you're taking a box of beer cans and slamming them into a brick wall at about 80 miles an hour. When they recovered the aircraft, they built a wall around it at Otis Air Force Base so that no one could see it, which is not very typical. The death certificate states that John Kennedy Jr. and his family died of multiple traumatic injuries. The remains were then taken to Duxbury County Crematory after an unprecedented examination of 45 minutes per body. The ashes were scattered at sea despite objections from the family members. And I have a copy of that death certificate as well. Just jumping back to the raid, to the weather, I have a visual here of the New York area weather radar, and it's showing how at 10 o'clock at night, New York and the Jersey area were pretty fogged in. Well, fogged in isn't the word, but very thick haze, but Martha's Vineyard was just still perfectly clear with 10 to 15 miles visibility.
Damon, this is Cheryl. You've got 5 minutes left. I just wanted to give you a reminder.
All right, so we're going to jump onto the secret FBI report. I was very lucky to get a copy of the secret FBI report, and I can't take credit for it. There was a very brilliant man by the name of Sherman Skolnick, and your organization should definitely research this man. He was a Mensa who was confined to a wheelchair. He had polio, and he's on record as taking out the greatest number of crooked politicians that ever existed. This guy was a real tiger and a tremendous researcher. And you can go online to Skolnick's report, and you can see all the things that he's written about. He did a write-up on John Jr., and it was called America's Golden Boy. And in that write-up, I was lucky enough to find the secret FBI report that Sherman absconded before they shut people off from coming in. Now, that report has been classified until 2029. No one can see it. But Sherman managed to grab it. And as soon as he grabbed it, the FBI shut down any public access to their files. So I'm going to read you the details. The first item one, no declassification of this until 7/22/2029. Item two, This is in deference to the wishes of a senior member of the Kennedy family. Okay, so we don't know who the hell that is. We got no idea. That could be Arnold Schwarzenegger. Also, in deference to the order of the national government in respect to certain foreign intelligence agencies having reciprocal agreements with the U.S. So what they're doing, they're setting up a smoke screen here to make it look like someone foreign, that there's a mystery. Some spy came in and just wanted to get rid of John, okay? Number four is interesting. POTUS order and national security findings attached. Okay, so something came straight from the White House, and we don't know what that is. The recovered aircraft shows evidence of an explosive device having been glued or affixed within the tail luggage compartment. The device was apparently actuated by a barometric trigger. Radio signals are not ruled out. Okay, that means that they wired it to an altimeter, and it was set to go off at a given altitude on his descent. Radio signals not being ruled out means there could have been someone in a boat that actually pushed a button and triggered it. But I think they probably went the barometric trigger way, because it's so much easier. Tail of the aircraft was dismembered from the plane, making it front heavy. So now we're going back to what I told you about, how he just went augured straight in, never had the time to even call out a distress. Study of radar shows the plane fell in excess of 6,000 feet per minute up to radar cutoff. That's an enormous rate of descent. Satellite images supplied by the National Reconnaissance Office record an outbursting flash from the aircraft just prior to it going into perpendicular descent. Okay, there was also a highfalutin lawyer from Philadelphia by the name of, we'll worry about his name later. He was fishing on the southwest corner, Victor Prebanek, that's his name, Prebanek. He was fishing on the southwest corner of the island. He heard the explosion in the sky. He was very concerned, and he knew the Kennedy. You see, he had seen a light plane in the area before it went. But he testifies to the explosion over and over again. Okay, there was an intern who worked for the Vineyard Gazette, and he actually saw the explosion, but they washed him away. They didn't let anybody near him. They said he never existed. But one of the other researchers did find him, and he's got a methodology for getting to him. I'm going to try that methodology to see if I can find that individual. And they were pretty smart about what they did. And what they did was they know that they got rid of the intern in September, so they kept looking to see who wrote all summer long, and suddenly someone's name disappeared. And that was the guy. And they found him, but they feel that he's in hiding because of this whole incident. Recovery of a piece of luggage from beyond the flight path of the aircraft correlates with it being hurtled out of the tail luggage compartment at outburst. Preliminary examination of the aircraft shows residue of an explosive device. The laboratory finds as being the type used by certain foreign intelligence agencies. Refer once again to the POTUS order and findings. So we got Billy Clinton's involved again. Study of air traffic control and other radio signals shows no Mayday report from the aircraft explained by rapidity of descent. Investigation and examination has been strictly compartmentalized, so we know what compartmentalization is about. One hand doesn't know what the other one's doing. A short perfunctory examination of the recovered bodies was completed. Examination revealed that Carolyn Bessette Kennedy was in third trimester pregnant. The fetus was a boy. The four bodies were transferred to a senior member of the Kennedy family. The Bureau was not informed whether the bodies were actually cremated. Indirect advisories report that the bodies may have been shipped in untagged containers to foreign destinations. Reliable assets are to submit reports. And that's the FBI report in a nutshell. So I'm sure that's about my 4 minutes. If you want to shoot some questions...
Yeah, let's do that. And thank you very much for that really informative lecture. Let me just put us in Q&A mode here. Okay, and I might have to unmute you again, Damon, so give me a moment. Okay. So if anyone would like to ask a question of Damon, please do *6. And Damon, while we're waiting for them to do that, maybe you could tell us a bit about the book you're writing.
Well, the book just encompasses everything that I just went over and just so much more because John was accumulating evidence on the killers of his father. He was really rustling at the Bushes in a big way. He was rustling the Clintons. He was directly in Hillary's way for the Senate seat in New York if he wanted to go for that. And a lot of people said he was doing that, but from my research, it didn't seem like he wanted that Senate seat. He wanted to go straight for the presidency, and it was just going to be a question of time that he was going to do it. I thought this might have been far-fetched, you know, and I'm very hesitant to accuse people until I think I really have something. But whether you love this guy or not, it doesn't matter. But I initially got writing this book with Roger Stone, and we all know who he is. And he was the one who encouraged me from the beginning. I grabbed him at a conference because he was one of the most impressive speakers. I didn't know who Roger Stone was. Let me just preface everything I'm about to tell you. But I had no idea who he was. He was just a public speaker that I was impressed with. I grabbed him when he came out of the men's room, and I said, listen, I'm a pilot. I've been researching this kind of stuff, and I really believe there was foul play with John Jr. and et cetera, et cetera. And we kept going on. We talked about it. I felt that there was Clinton involvement, and I didn't see Roger again for 2 years. The 2 years later, Roger came up to me, and he said, you know, I discounted what you said to me a couple of years ago. He said, but then I was talking to some people in the Democratic Party in New York, and these guys were really PO'd. And he said, apparently, these people had a conversation with Hillary Clinton. They said, well, what are you going to do when John decides he's going for that Senate seat? And he sure deserves it a lot more than you do, because you just moved to this state so that you could grab it. And according to Roger, Hillary turned her nose up. She looked at, or according to Roger's sources, Hillary turned her nose up and she said, he's not going to be a problem. He's not going to be a problem. So the book is, right now it's at about 250 pages. I expect it's going to be about 600 because I've got to tell the Bush story as well. you know, just keep your eyes open for it. I think I'm just going to title it, Who Murdered John Kennedy Jr.? Just plain and simple.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Great. Thank you. So we do have some questions here from people. So let me get started with that. Xander Arena, you're up first. Go ahead.
Hey, this is Xander. Great presentation. There's a video online. It's JFK Bush Connection 2, or JFK 2, the Bush Connection, by a guy named John Hinckley, I think is the name. And he did another movie about John F. Kennedy Jr., and I'm wondering if you've seen that other film, and is he accurate in his presentation?
Yeah, you're talking Dark Legacy 2 is the second production. It was Dark Legacy 1 was more about the Bushes and the Nazi ties. Dark Legacy 2 is about John Jr. and how they got rid of him.
Yeah, okay. So
Hanky was very accurate in a lot of his reporting. In fact, I mean, he was inspirational to me, to be perfectly honest. He hit a lot of stuff directly on target, but he missed a lot of stuff not being an aviation professional. And he's also the one that really subscribes to the Manchurian flight instructor concept, which just no way, shape, or form that I can support that. I don't see that there. But Hanky is on target, and that video is well worth watching.
Awesome, man. Dark Legacy 2, thanks for that. And thanks for adding to that narrative and really, developing it and bringing all of your expertise to the table, man. I cannot wait to read your book. Thank you.
Yeah, another character here is Bob Arnault, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with him. You see him in television commercials. He's supposedly a doctor, but he came out and said that he was flying out to Nantucket that night. Actually, who he was he was the NBC aviation specialist, and he used to report on anything that had to do with the aviation. The guy's a high-time military pilot, a big-time Air Force pilot, and from my perception on this, he was caught in he was right in the middle of the cover-up. And his story makes absolutely no sense. But these are all these tangents, you see. As I got into the book, I tag onto a tangent and off I would go. But Arnault was fired from NBC because his colleagues lost faith in him. And they felt that when he was reporting on the Iran scandals, that he was giving unfair favoritism to the military. So the Shapiros fired him from NBC. But the guy still, he came out in the 20th anniversary show that ABC did, and he reiterates his story, but he changed it a little differently. He said his nephew looked out of the plane and said he couldn't see the island, and if somebody were out there and he didn't have an instrument flight rating, he'd be in big trouble. You know, it's just a crock of crap. And if he couldn't see out of his airplane, what was he doing flying there in VFR conditions? It doesn't make any sense. But anyway, these are the kind of tangents, and there's one right after another. It's incredible when you get into research. I'm sorry. Next question.
Okay. All set, Xander?
All set.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Okay. Great. Okay. Malcolm Arnold, you're next. Go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering as far as if you could just reiterate Richard Skolnick, American's Golden Boy, if you could how do you spell his name so I can look up that article? And then I have a couple other questions.
The only word that I understood was article. Can you, Cheryl, did you get that any better than I did?
No. Can you repeat that, Malcolm?
Sure. You mentioned the article by Richard Skolnick, America's Golden Boy.
That's Sherman Skolnick, America's Golden Boy.
Okay.
Skolnick's report is what you're looking for if you want to go to look for that. Someone I referred to it said it's gone, but it may still be there.
And how do you spell Skolnick?
S-K-O-L, Skol, N-I-C-K.
Okay, and you said that the plane went negative to perpendicular, and wouldn't an explosion cause the plane not to do that, and then would cause the plane to actually, because then the plane would actually, like, spin in the air, which would actually slow, just like a
No, absolutely not. It would go straight in. It would go straight in.
Okay.
Your tail's gone. There's nothing to hold the airplane in the spin.
Right.
All you've got is a big giant engine up front, and that's what's pulling you straight to the water.
Got it. And for those who might not know, you may want to explain the relationship between temperature and dew point. I don't know if you did that with regards to visibility.
Yeah, what about the relationship between temperature and dew point?
Well, you mentioned that there was a big enough spread between temperature and dew point, but I don't know if you explained what the implications are for that with regards to visibility.
Well, the wider the spread on your temperature and dew point, the better the visibility. As your temperature and dew point approach each other as they get closer, let's say your temperature was 73. If your dew point comes up to 73, it means that the air is 100% saturated, which means that you would be essentially in fog.
Right.
Okay, but the temperature dew point spreads were healthy all the way.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Yeah,
okay.
It sure did. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Malcolm. And next we have Sherry Aspen. Sherry, go ahead.
Hello, this is Sherry in San Diego. Thank you very much. It's so interesting. I just have a question. Do you know what his cousin, Robert Kennedy Jr., thinks about this?
I don't. It's been a source of frustration for me because it's like the word is mum with the Kennedy family. I had, what's his name there? Patrick was my senator there in Rhode Island, and I couldn't penetrate the Kennedy family from any aspect. I've got a friend now that's close to Robert, and, you know, maybe I could get him to pry something open there, but I've just had no success with any of them. No.
It seems to me that he might be more willing. I don't know. I just have this intuition because of the way he's fighting out against these experimental injections, you know, he's really speaking out.
Well, I know he's out front, you know, absolutely. You know, but when it comes to people murdering members of your family, I think maybe you tend to be a little more careful.
Right. I know. But I wondered. He's been a warrior.
So, I'd love to know. Actually, I've got a close associate of mine is a cousin of John's. I think she's a third cousin or something like that. And she even said that, she said apparently one of the other cousins was also flying out there that night, and they actually landed after John did. But I've never gotten her to confirm this. She wound up with breast cancer and some other stuff, so she had some issues, and I've never been able to firm that up. You know, she was supposed to get a hold of that cousin and see what they said, but that was just going to be further proof that the visibility and those conditions were excellent. But we already know it was. You know, I mean, there's already a whole lot of reports that
they don't want another Kennedy in the White House. So, you know, they didn't. That's what was going to happen. I think he would. I think he could have become president.
Well, it all came from there. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it was Bush's and Clinton sat down. And they said he's got to go, and this is how they did it. It's just that simple.
I would like this Robert Kennedy Jr. to run for president. I wrote a letter to him and asked him.
There's some talk about the Mossad being involved too. John did a lot of. I managed to scoff. I've got every copy of George magazine, and some of them cost me $50. They weren't easy to get, but John shredded a lot of people in there, and the Mossad was one of them. So I suppose there's possible motivation there. We know that they really hated the Kennedys to begin with, but I hate to drag them into it because I don't feel that they were the prime directors here. I really think it came from the two families that I just mentioned, you know. And if anybody believes that those two families are actually political opponents, wake up, because they are one crime family, the Bushes and the Clintons. You know, they're the ones that have been running the drugs and the guns back and forth together for years and years. They might fool you to make you think that they were political opposites, but no way.
Right. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Sherry. Okay, next we have Joe Baltar. Joe, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for putting in all the hard work. I bring some baggage to the table. From 1989 through 2002, for 13 years, I organized a conference in New England looking at crimes committed by FBI agents. It was held at Bates College for 11 years, the first year at Boston University, and the last year at the University of Maine.
Joe, I don't know. Are you having a hard time hearing him?
No, I
Damon?
Can't hear him at all. Yeah.
Yeah, Joe, I don't know. Are you on speakerphone, or are you
okay now?
Much
can
better.
You hear
yeah.
Me?
Yeah.
All right.
Much better.
I'm going to just briefly state that I was involved organizing a conference for 13 consecutive years in New England, looking at crimes committed by FBI agents. And it was from 1989 through 2002. And I have a few resources I wanted to share with you.
You're fading again.
Yeah, I'm losing them now. It's just
most
important.
Let me
thing.
Give you my phone number, and I want to make sure you have that. It's area code 207-778-6244.
Hang on, back it up. I'm sorry, Joe. Give it to me again.
Area code 207.
207.
778. 6244. 6244. All right, area code 207. Now, I want to just tell you a couple of resources. Michael Parenti, the author, has written a book called Dirty Truths, which deals with the assassination of labor organizer Walter Reuther by his plane. Someone tampered with the gauges in the plane.
Oh, yeah, Joe. If you want to get rid of somebody, the airplane is the vehicle.
Absolutely.
You know, Ed, what was his name there? The senator there they got rid of up in Alaska there. Cokie Roberts' father.
Right. So you're way ahead of me. I have a friend that we brought to our conference twice who lives in Quincy, Mass, who's one of the leading JFK assassination researchers in the country, and his name is Ed Tatro, T-A-T-R-O.
I know Ed.
Okay. So we brought him twice. I was able to get documents to him about Hoover and Tolson at the Del Charro Motel run by the Murchison family from Texas. So last two pieces, and then I'll let the next person talk. You may want to look at the website of attorney John Clark, and that's spelled C-L-A-R-K-E, and the website is FBICoverUp.com, and it looks at the cover-up of the Vince Foster murder. John Clark we brought to our conference, and he represented somebody who was in the park the day that Vince Foster's body was dumped there, and has put together an amazing package of evidence that's at his website. So I would want to refer you to the website, FBICoverUp.com.
Yep.
And the last piece is some of the people here know about the Oklahoma City bombing and the work of Salt Lake attorney Jesse Trentadue. And Trentadue has been pursuing John Doe number two, as well as the videos that he took from the buildings close to the Murrow building when it exploded. Now, Jesse Trentadue's son-in-law just died in a plane crash, and you may want to look at that as just an added piece of using air disasters to intimidate or get rid of people, et cetera. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, actually, I've got a website that I sort of took over from Rodney Stitch when he passed away. And
really?
I try to cover airplane disasters there. And this is it's the most common form of assassination. I mean, they took down
absolutely.
An entire plane to get rid of St. John Hunt's mother, to get rid of Howard
absolutely,
Hunt.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right,
Howard Hunt's wife.
I would like to hear the phone, and I'd like to talk to you more. And I'm currently shooting a documentary. I want to recommend the website, and then I'm going to hang up from the forum here. It's AmericansWhoTellTheTruth.org.
Say that again, Joe.
AmericansWhoTellTheTruth.org.
And it's a website of a Maine artist who's painted over 250 portraits. And each portrait has a quotation written directly on the canvas.
Okay.
And there's a curriculum that goes with the portraits. So, again,
okay.
Thank you so much for the great work you're doing, and I really would like to talk to you.
What's a good time to call you, Joe?
Anytime, for the most part, yeah.
All right. Okay, give you a shout.
All right, take care.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Okay. Next is Jane Clark. Jane, go ahead. Jane, are you there? Jane? Okay, so we'll go on to the next one. And Carl Gullivan, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Carl. Thank you very much for your presentation. And a question or a comment, really, I'd like to draw in reference to a text I want to recommend to you. You mentioned initially we were following the Kennedy assassination. There's a very new book by author Laurent, L-A-U-R-E-N-T, Guyeno, G-U-Y-E-N-O-T.
Yeah,
titled
actually, I've got it.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
I've got it. And he's pretty good. Just to elaborate on that, it was Ann sent me some of his stuff the other day. And he is the only other one who picked up on the Bob Arnault thing that I was telling you about. He's the only other researcher that's picked out some really strong detail. I'm impressed with his work. I'd like to talk to him at some point. But
yes,
he missed a lot too. I mean, this is a lot of people have fragments. You know, this is like with the other book there that what the heck is the name of it? Shows it. It's maybe 125 pages, and it shows the airplane on an angle and going straight in. And we had spoken about it, but the guy launches his whole book by he starts with motive, He just completely exonerates the Clintons and completely blames it on the Bushes. There aren't too many books that are published on this. There's another guy, a PhD, that published this very nice big giant picture book that costs about $50. And it's just totally loaded with inaccuracies. This guy's published 38 books, and he did a totally lousy job on this. He claimed he found the tail of the airplane, and he's got a black and white.
No, you're speaking of someone completely different than Lawrence Guyano.
No, I'm not talking about him now. I'm talking about the other books that have been put out.
Right. Can I just briefly, as an overview for the point I wanted to raise, I actually mailed Ann the copy of Guyano's book, The Unspoken Kennedy Truth, that perhaps she passed that on to you. She said she'd given it to someone. But his whole thesis, he essentially frames the period of time from JFK's assassination, actually even going back to James Forrestal's apparent assassination, all the way through RFK's assassination, as traceable to the same Zionist interests and objectives as Christopher Berlin,
sure.
Of course.
I don't know. I thought we all knew that. I mean, it's just a continuation of that whole.
If I could just finish the thought. No, I don't think we all know at all that the Kennedy assassinations, even going back to Forrestal, who's a close family friend all the way through RFK, could be traceable to, of course, JFK's trying to prevent Israel from getting nuclear weapons and also compelling their lobby to register as a foreign agent. But just to tie this in together, Guyano does devote a chapter to John Jr.'s death. And I think it's noteworthy that the patriarch, Joseph Kennedy, there's almost, some do say, a curse on his family. The scriptures say the sins of the father are passed down to the third or the fourth generation of those who, who sin, I guess one would say. But Joseph Kennedy was, of course, known to have been a supporter of Neville Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler, and as a result, at various Kennedy events, people would show up with black umbrellas, which were like the symbol of Neville Chamberlain. And actually, the person who held aloft the one lone umbrella by the time it was a sunny day in Dallas actually testified in 1978 that he was doing it exactly for that purpose. Someone had told him, oh, the black umbrella is a sore spot for the Kennedys. So that's why the black umbrella was displayed in Dealey Plaza just as the shots rang out. But the thought you prompted sort of an odd connection. In the chapter on John Jr., Guyano quotes from an article in the Religion News Service that there might yet be a Kennedy male heir in the White House. And he's quoting a rabbi, Jeffrey Selkin. The title of the article is, will JFK's grandson become the first Jewish president? Of course, Jack Schlossberg is son of Caroline Kennedy, and she's married to Jewish Edwin Schlossberg. And it's sort of interesting that could all come about. But you said that Caroline was supposed to be on the plane, and she did not join the plane.
No, I didn't say that. I said Carolyn was Carolyn. Carolyn
oh,
is his
okay.
wife. Carolyn
okay,
is his
thank
wife.
You.
Caroline is his sister.
Thank you for
Carolyn
clarifying
was late
that.
Getting to the plane because she was getting a pedicure.
I'm very glad you clarified, because it would have added one level of peculiarity if Caroline, his sister was also in the area.
Caroline was all pissed off with him because, excuse me, but Caroline was all pissed off with him because he was getting into the Kennedy dirt and the murderers,
right.
And who was taking him out, and she was just
right. And so,
and
I mean,
think about it. How come all of a sudden she winds up being ambassador to Japan and she just takes off? You know, I mean,
well,
the whole thing. But we're off topic here. Does anybody else want to be on the?
We have three more questions. Thank you, Carl.
Rahm Emanuel, his father was Mossad, and he was chief advisor to Clinton and Obama. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Carl. Okay. Jane Clark, are you there with us? Jane?
Yeah, this is Jane Clark.
Yes.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay.
Okay, I was wondering if you are familiar with Christopher Fulton and his new book, The Inheritance.
Actually, I'm working tight with Chris Fulton.
Oh, good, good. Okay,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
His
Chris
book, I just finished
in
it.
In fact, I found a piece that verifies his story on the Cartier watch. You know, his.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you've read the book, then you know what I'm talking about. But he claims that the Cartier watch. Just for the rest of you that don't know, John Kennedy was wearing a Cartier watch that his wife had given him when he got assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
That was a single piece of evidence that, what was her first name there? Mrs. Lincoln, Kennedy's
Evelyn.
Kennedy's secretary. She had absconded the watch, and it wound up in Chris Fulton's hands, and he wound up being incarcerated because he wouldn't give it over. He wound up giving it to John Jr. Now, that watch was still encrusted with DNA and with mercury, so this would have lent to the frangible bullet theory, which now all of a sudden, oh, guess what? We got more than one shooter in Dallas. But I just happened to be, I was doing some research one day, and I saw something about the net worth of John Jr. at the time of his death. And this was Fox Business News. And so they're going through the various assets, and they talked about, you know, he probably was worth $200 million with this, and he had these assets, that assets. And all of these were transferred to the Schlossbergs along with the gold Cartier watch. So the watch was real, and John had it in his hands, and it was a piece of evidence. Okay, and
I can tell you
that he was gathering evidence on the Bushes. He had it. He had the evidence on George Bush Sr., and he was going to take him down with a grand jury. So that started that. He didn't have anything on the Clintons. He was critical of the Clintons, but he didn't have anything on them. And I think that they had taken him, or he had taken them into his confidence and trusted him just a little bit too much, and that cost him.
I think the Clintons learned from the Bushes, personally. They taught them well. But the bottom line is, can I give you my phone number as well? I would like to... I've looked everywhere on Pacer trying to find information on his imprisonment. I can't find anything. And I guess what he said in the book was true. It's not in the public records.
Well, it's not just that. The book's written in novel form. Okay, so it's not the book is not a documentary by any means.
No, I know, but I just was trying to find...
And there's fiction that's worked into there.
Federal cases.
But I can tell you a little secret that I know.
Okay.
And the secret is that Chris Fulton's mother had an affair with Robert Kennedy.
Okay.
Now, you can take what you want from that. Okay, but if you've seen Chris in his appearance and his mannerisms and the way he talks, he's on the
duplicate. Oh, he sounds like a Kennedy.
He sounds just like him.
Right.
Just like him. Because
I question
the authenticity of Chris Fulton along with a bunch of other people, and I grabbed, I know the publisher, and I grabbed him and I said, listen, you know, I need a little more to go on here. And he says, this is the deal. So there's a possibility Chris Fulton is the illegitimate child of Robert Jr.
Oh, my. Well, I mean, I'm an attorney, and I've been trying to find anything in the public record relating to him, and I'm not finding it. But I would like to—I'd like to give you my phone number because I've been researching the Kennedys for 50 years.
Sure.
817.
817.
966.
966.
6037.
6037. I'm sorry, your name again?
I'm Jane Clark.
I got the clock part. I haven't got your first name.
Jane, like Tarzan.
Oh, okay, Jane.
I'm in Texas. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Is
all right,
that
thanks,
an E,
Jane,
or is that just a plain K?
Just no E. Just plain K.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. Okay, we have two more questions. The next one is Bonnie Faulkner. Bonnie, go ahead. Yes, a couple of questions. Briefly, you mentioned that the secret FBI report that Sherman Skolnick had his hands on mentioned several times the involvement of foreign intel agencies, and I was going to ask you why you were discounting that. Then you went on to mention that John Jr. in his George magazine had been writing about the Mossad. I'm assuming that's what you were alluding to. So I'd like to know, number one, what did John Jr. in this George magazine expose or write about the Mossad? That's one. That's number one. And number two, what did
Well, let's deal with that one first.
Okay.
Okay. Deal with that one first. The article on the Mossad was all about the assassination of Rabin.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, and the assassination of Rabin was another Siran. Okay, and what John did was he gotten the assassin's, or the alleged assassin's mother, and got her whole side of the story. And she said, this is absurd, my son did not do this, he was set up by the Mossad, he was programmed by the Mossad, et cetera, et cetera. And John exposed all this.
And her son was whom?
I'm sorry?
Her son was whom?
No, nope, I don't understand what you're asking.
You're talking about the assassination of Rabin, right?
Correct.
Yes. Well, what was he exposing? Whose mother are you talking about?
The assassin's mother.
Right.
Right. John got a hold of the assassin's mother and got the real story on the murder.
Okay.
Okay, which the mother says this was an inside job and the Mossad did this.
Yeah.
This was not my son.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, I didn't understand you. Thank you.
Okay.
And then secondly, what did you think about Carolyn Kennedy out there on the Navy ship when her brother is being, quote, buried at sea? That struck me as really weird.
What, the burial at sea? Or you mean the scattering of the ashes at sea?
Well, yes, that. But, of course, that Carolyn Kennedy, his own sister, was taking part in this.
Well, I mean, what's she supposed to do? Teddy was there, too, you know? She's not going to go to her own brother's ashes. And frankly, the ashes, it's another big point of debate, because there are people on both sides that say that the Kennedy family wanted it that way, the Kennedy family didn't want it that way. There are sources that say, sources within the government insisted that it go this way. So, you know, Ted is probably the only one that would have known the truth about all of this stuff, but unfortunately he's gone now. But I think they just, to be perfectly frank, I just think they wanted to erase any and all evidence that may indicate that there were explosives on the airplane.
Well, obviously, but I mean, I just thought it was rather shocking. The Kennedy family has to know that he got bumped off, and they're participating with the government with it. I don't get it. Well, anyway.
Well, how many members of your family have to die before you're afraid of them? You know, that's and you have to understand, the Kennedys live in terror.
Well, yes, of course. I know they've all been targeted. I realize that. All right. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, and one last question. Thanks, Bonnie. And then we have Ann Hendricks. Ann, go ahead.
Hi, Damon. This is Ann. Thanks so much for your work. I got a couple of questions. Let's see. In particular, Carolyn's delay. You had mentioned that there was word, I think, from Adam Budd or somebody, that John expected to arrive at 7:30. And then you also mentioned that he radioed, was it 9:39, about his landing on Martha's Vineyard, right?
I think 9:39, he was already in. I can go back to that screen
well,
and get the time.
Well, approximately. Okay, we're
We've
talking
got,
about two.
Yeah, hang
two,
on, we got it.
Yeah.
Okay, initially he calls at 1:30 in the afternoon, and he told operations that he was going to arrive at 7:30 p.m. Okay, but we know, which meant that he would have been leaving Essex at 6:30. But Carolyn was 2 hours late with the pedicure.
Got it. Okay. So, first of all, I think that this must speak to extreme trust by Carolyn If she's willing to delay this flight, which is could put them into darkness, I mean, she must have extreme trust with him as a pilot. She must have flown with him lots and not be concerned at all about him flying in the dark.
It's a good observation.
It seems odd that she would.
I found absolutely no indication that she had apprehensions about getting into an airplane with him. There are stories that circulate about that, too. But I think
right.
that's just more smoke screen.
Yeah. Okay.
You know,
well,
she flew with him plenty of times. And she, would she take her sister along, too, if she didn't trust him? I mean, let's be real.
Right. Yeah.
Not to mention, in the FBI report, she's carrying a baby.
Yeah. Okay. So my point is about the delay. If there was, an hour and a half to 2 hour delay, and if there was something planted in the tail of that airplane, an explosive planted, then somehow somebody had to be tracking it. And, you know, so they would have been aware that how much later it was. For instance, if you had a boat out in that water, because all
yeah,
that
the,
time
the
he was following...
The barometric trigger doesn't work that way, dear, right? Because that's based on altitude. All they set the bomb in there, and when the airplane comes through that altitude, the bomb goes off. They don't have to track it.
So you're saying that perhaps at the moment that he began to descend, a bomb, an explosive could have been set to go off at
yeah,
well, that.
Yeah, it was set to go off when he came down through 2,500 feet.
Oh, interesting.
See,
it wasn't
set to go
gotcha.
When he took off. It wasn't set to go en route when he was at 5,500. It was set to come off when he was back there on the final approach.
Okay. All right. And the other point is about the Pentagon getting involved at 6:30, or the Air Force getting involved at 6:30. So they didn't necessarily know, because if they were, say if they were involved prior to that, like in a premeditated way, they would probably have taken it off Coast Guard's hands much quicker than they did.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, maybe. I mean, you've also got to give time for all of the official, the agencies that are supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. You've got to give that time. So were you, if they jumped in right away, wouldn't it look suspicious? You know,
yeah.
If all of a sudden they just said, sorry, this doesn't belong to you, get out of here. You know, which is essentially what they did with TWA Flight 800.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I'll hold my other questions. Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Ann. Damon, thank you very much for being with us tonight. And I really learned a lot from that. It sounds like other people had great interest also. And thanks again. And good luck with the book. Let us know when it comes out. And you're welcome to stay on the call. We're having next is Ted Walter is going to be on speaking about architects and engineers, some of their issues and things they're working on. So it's up to you.
Sure.
All right,
can you keep me on your roster? Can you let me know when you're having your meetings and what's going on?
Sure. We'll add you to it. Sounds great.
Yeah, I'd like to get in with the group. You got a smart bunch
absolutely.
There. I was looking at your website the other day. There's a lot of good work there.
Yeah, that's Craig, yeah.
And there's a ton of junk around, you know. There's a fellow, I got real disturbed. There's a fellow that just did a whole video on what happened with John Jr. And all this guy did was show us that he knew how to fly instruments, is the bottom line, that he personally, the guy that wrote it. And I was critical
uh-huh.
of him. I said, this is great, but all you did was take the official story, get in your airplane, and go out and fly the official story. I said, look deeper. This is not what happened. Well, you know, I wrote it as I saw it, but there's this half-hour YouTube video out there that looks great to the naked eye, you know, for people who are not really up on the snuff and what's going on, but disinformation goes, you know.
Right. There's a lot of it out there.
Very sad. Oh, same
yeah.
thing with 9/11.
All right, well, we'll add you to the list. Thank you very much, Damon, and we'll
good.
Be in touch.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So we're going back into lecture mode, and now we're going to hear from our second speaker, And let me just get there. And okay, I'm going to unmute you, Ted. And Craig is going to introduce Ted. So go ahead, Craig. Craig, are you here?
Yes, I am. I am here. Are you hearing me? Okay.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, I don't have to give Ted a big introduction because he's been on our call a number of times before. Ted Walter is the Director of Strategy and Development for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And he's going to give us a brief sort of update on what architects and engineers are doing for the 20th anniversary. And he might also mention sort of what the update is on the request for correction that was filed in 2020, and where that might be going in terms of further legal action. So I'm going to hand it over to Ted. You're there, Ted?
Yeah. Hey, Craig. Hey, Cheryl. Hi, everybody. Thank
Hi.
You so much for having me on. Hey there. So yeah, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, we have a few big things that we are planning for the 20th anniversary, which is obviously a little more than a month away. Craig mentioned the request for correction, which is an initiative that started back in the spring of 2020, shortly after the release of the University of Alaska Fairbanks report by Professor Leroy Halsey up there. And we submitted a request for correction to NIST that was partially relying on the findings of the University of Alaska report, and as well as other areas of evidence related to the destruction of Building 7. The request for correction is a administrative process where federal agencies that disseminate information, you're allowed to basically challenge that information if you think that it doesn't meet the information quality standards that the agency has established by law. And we think that this report, in many regards, did not meet NIST's information quality standards, and that's what the request for correction shows in about 100 pages. That process went throughout last year and into this year. We had filed it back in the spring. We got an initial decision from NIST in late August. We filed an appeal of their initial decision in late September, and then we waited for about 9 months to finally get their final decision, which we were anticipating was probably going to be to deny the request. And I'm sorry if this is all a lot of detail, trying to kind of explain it in a nutshell here, but along the way, we believe that NIST, and it'd be obvious to anybody who's followed the story over the years, but NIST had totally avoided actually responding to any of our arguments. We had about 100 pages in the request, 100 pages in the appeal, and responding to their very short initial decision from last August. And we believe that their unresponsiveness in their decisions violates the law, violates the Data Quality Act, which is the act that enables all this process to take place, as well as another law, that the Administrative Procedure Act, which sort of governs how agencies are supposed to behave. So we are going to be filing a lawsuit against NIST by the end of August, showing that they have violated the Data Quality Act and trying to get a federal court to force NIST to go back and actually respond to our request for correction. So that we will be filing that towards the end of August, and that will probably take a number of months. I don't know exactly how long. We're working with Nick Harrison, the litigation director for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. He is the one who will be drafting the complaint and litigating that case. And so that will be in the works when the 20th anniversary rolls around. We will have just filed this lawsuit against NIST. That, along with some of the other initiatives that we have going, we hope will, gain some exposure, some attention in the mainstream media and the alternative media. It is a time every year where we get a increased exposure. We get hundreds of thousands of visitors to our website in the few days around the anniversary. And this year, with the 20th anniversary, we expect that to be, a lot more. So
we hope that the NIST thing will get some attention, and of course we are hopeful that it will ultimately prevail. Obviously the courts are going to be, the assumption is that the courts will be deferential to the agency, that they'll be biased against us, that they might see us just as conspiracy theorists. But we'll see what happens. It is a fight that we have to fight. The other major legal initiative that will have been submitted by the 20th anniversary, which perhaps has even more potential to sort of capture the attention of the general public and be talked about in the media, is the submittal of the application by the family of Jeff Campbell, who died on 9/11 in the North Tower. He was a UK citizen. His brother, Matt Campbell, is somebody who a lot of 9/11 Truth activists at this point will be familiar with. He and all of the members of his family are submitting this application to get a new inquest into the death of Jeff. This is a process that is allowed for under British law. Anytime that there is a death that happens in sort of unusual or suspicious circumstances, there is an inquest to find out what was the cause of the person's death. And there was an inquest for Jeff Campbell in 2013, and which found that Jeff Campbell died because of the collapse of the towers following the impact of the airplanes. And so we can challenge that finding. We started this project about a year ago. We started working with the barrister in the United Kingdom last summer. Some people might remember, we fundraised for this effort back in August of last year, which all of the funds went to pay for this barrister to do his work. It's such an enormous application with thousands of pages that it's taken longer than anticipated, but we're happy that the application is basically being finalized as we speak and will be submitted as well by the end of August. And this has already gained some mainstream media attention in the UK, from the Daily Mail, as well as from the local BBC radio station where Campbell family lives. And we think that it will continue to pique the interest of the British, at least the British public. This sort of thing is like common in British kind of political culture, whether it's like Bloody Sunday or the Hillsborough disaster or other things, maybe things related to the Troubles. Besides Bloody Sunday, there's a real sort of support for going back and openness to going back and investigating what actually happened in the case of violent murders and so on. So we're really the law related to this this whole process is very much in our favor. The whole point of the law is that it's actually very easy for families to get a new inquest if there's any new evidence or any evidence that wasn't considered at the first inquest that could change the original verdict. The law is designed to make it easy for families to get a new inquest. You only have to meet a threshold that there's new evidence that wasn't considered before that could possibly change the original verdict. And it's really not for the Attorney General of the UK to decide definitively whether the evidence proves that the original verdict is wrong. There just has to be a reasonable possibility. So we think that we easily meet that threshold. And it would have to be an incredibly egregious decision on the part of the Attorney General, which is the first hoop that we have to jump through. This is a member of Boris Johnson's cabinet, and that person's office who will be reviewing the application. But we think that the evidence is so overwhelming and that the threshold is so low that we're still pretty optimistic that we will get the legal authority to go forward and seek the new inquest. So those are the big legal initiatives that we have going that will both be fully in the works by the 20th anniversary, and we hope that will sort of add a lot of momentum to the 9/11 truth movement and energy and just general attention and, really making the case clear that the 9/11 Truth Movement is alive and kicking and active. And in both cases, we have many 9/11 family members involved in these efforts. So the 9/11 families, 20 years later, are still fighting, some of them at least. We are honored to be working with them. and helping them. Once we get past that, the two big things that we have planned are the release of a graphic novel, which our employee Andy Steele has spent the last 4 years writing and illustrating, and we actually first announced that just yesterday that this graphic novel was going to be coming out in September, and we started a pre-sale where the book can be bought at a 20% discount. It's 380 pages of illustrations and incredibly vivid stories, vivid, you know, powerful characters, really powerful stories. A lot of evidence, controlled demolition evidence, is in the book as well. Craig had a big hand in helping to edit the book with Andy Steele. Richard also, you know, reviewed it from a technical standpoint, and many people contributed to it. But really, you know, 99% of the effort was Andy Steele, and it's I think an incredible work of art. So I really encourage people to, you know, buy a copy. It's not that expensive for a 380-page book. It will be $25 in September. It's $20 now. But just support this work of art. And it's a powerful story about a boy who was born on 9/11 the same day his father, I mean, this is fictional, of course, but he's born on 9/11 the same day his father, who was a firefighter, died in the towers. And it's sort of about him coming of age and starting to question the official story and going on a crusade to try to expose the truth and raise awareness around the murder of his father. It's very entertaining. That's one thing, and we hope that it will get out there and, you know, maybe reach a whole new audience that we haven't reached yet. Maybe a younger audience who's really doesn't know much about 9/11, who's just encountering it for the first time with this 20th anniversary. So there's that, and then there's a film that we have been working on over the last couple months with Dylan Avery. Once again, I think everyone here probably knows who he is, the creator of Loose Change, and then he also directed Film 7, which we released last year, about the University of Alaska study. This film is really just focusing on the stories of four different 9/11 families that we have worked with over the years to, you know, raise awareness and get a new investigation. And it will be premiering, and one of those families is the Campbell family. So it's going to be very current, looking at the latest, you know, the trajectory of these, you know, we're interviewing multiple people in each family. So it's really a very sort of multidimensional story. It's not just like one person from each family who happens to be, you know, the activist or whatever. It's really looking at the experience of all these families, what they've been through, their own internal struggles, and then their struggles with the world that has really ignored them and exploited their grief. And with a real highlighting the upcoming inquest effort. So that film, is in production right now, in production/post-production. Very exciting, very beautiful footage, really powerful stories. And will be released in September. We're going to be having a premiere the week leading up to the anniversary, so either the 7th or the 8th at Angelica Film, Angelica Theater in Greenwich Village. Also a release online. We're going to make the film available for free, at least for a limited time, for, you know, one, maybe a few months or a month, in the month of September. And, you know, we hope that it will, with all the traction that we will get, we get, as I mentioned before, lots of visitors to our website around the anniversary. We expect even more this year, maybe exponentially more. And so we want people to be able to watch the film on our website or, you know, find it very easily and watch it. You can find it easily on our website and be able to watch it for free online. That's sort of the four main things that we have going. Of course, there's just sort of the normal things that we're doing all the time, like presentations, outreach, et cetera. But those are the highlights. And also Richard Gage, who I think is here, will be speaking at the event that the Lawyers Committee is hosting on the on the 20th anniversary on September 11th in New York City, and where we will probably be screening the film for a second time following the premiere a few days earlier. So that's everything in a nutshell. Happy to answer questions and get people
okay,
talking.
Thanks so much, Ted, for coming on at a short notice and filling us in on that. Let me put us in Q&A mode here. So I will unmute you. Okay, if anyone has a question for Ted, please do star 6. Okay, so we have a question here from Xander Arena. Xander, go ahead.
Hey, Ted, thanks for the update. So I had heard some buzz that some of the venues might have been changing. I'm happy to hear that there's still going to be anniversary activities going on because I've got a trip planned out there to New York. Just wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little bit on the activities on the anniversary itself on the 11th.
Yeah, so that, yeah, the event, that event is being sponsored and organized by the Lawyers Committee. And so I don't know that much about it, and I believe that they are in the process of they have found a place that they're hoping to close a deal on by the end of the week. And they did lose out on a couple other opportunities at some other venues. But I think that they're figuring it out. But I don't know. I actually don't know what the venue is. They're totally determined to make it happen. Richard might know more than me, but to answer the other question, Xander, I don't know when you're getting out to New York City, but we are looking at the 8th as the most likely date for the for our film premiere at Angelica Theater, which is on Houston and Mercer in Greenwich Village.
Okay, man. Awesome. Thanks for all the info.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, we have a question now from Carl Gulliman. Carl, go ahead.
Ted, hi. Thank you for your update. And I know AE 911 Truth doesn't take any position on the who or why 9/11 occurred, but just wondering whether the court in Britain might benefit from having access to a copy of Christopher Boleyn's Solving 9/11. I'm kind of late to having realized it's a really exhaustive and definitive, well-argued case.
Yeah, so good question. The coroner's court in the UK that will hopefully eventually be holding this inquest will only be concerned with how Jeff Campbell died. They don't investigate at all who did it. It's just a like pure proximate causation, where we will be making the case, obviously, that the building, the North Tower, as well as the other two, were brought down by controlled demolition. That kind of evidence wouldn't really fit into the scope of this inquiry. And all the evidence that we're presenting is, generally speaking, scientific evidence of controlled demolition and so on. However, I think once the inquest is done, I think that obviously there's actually no legal, there's actually from that point, no strict legal mandate for anything new to happen as a result. Let's say if the coroner ultimately finds that, Jeff Campbell was killed in a controlled demolition, there is nothing that triggered automatically that would happen. But there are, and I myself should get very clear on this, but there may be avenues for the Campbell family to pursue in the UK. And then I think there will be just sort of shockwaves that will emanate from that development in the UK as well as in the US with 9/11 families in the US. And, we'll see what sort of legal actions could take place or what sort of criminal investigations could take place as a result of if the inquest going the way that we want it to go. And then, of course, things like Christopher Boleyn's research and other research will come in very handy when those kinds of investigations take place, but not at the inquest.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Carl.
No problem.
Okay, looks like we don't have any more questions Ted, I just want to give a plug for you. I just bought 3 copies of Andy Steele's book, and I'm going to donate 2 to the local libraries and keep 1 for myself. So just and with your good price right now, I could get the 3 for $49. So if anyone else is interested, that's a great deal. So
awesome.
So thanks a lot, Ted. Anyone else? Any other questions? Looks like we're good. Okay, thank you for coming on, as I said, last minute, Ted, and look forward to seeing you hopefully on the anniversary in New York.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Yeah.
Look forward to it.
Okay. So now I'm going to unmute everybody, and okay, so this is where we go into a discussion, anything anyone wants to bring up or announcements. Anybody have anything? Just speak out. Okay, I just did. I just wanted to bring up the fact that I think that with the COVID thing, that the government is getting really aggressive, and I think we have a short window, perhaps when school and all that starts in the fall, that they're going to be really mandating vaccines and forcibly vaccinating people. I hope I'm wrong, but. So it's very frightening to me, and I just wondered if anyone had any thoughts about that or any comments or wanted to discuss that. Now, this is a talkative group, and nobody's saying. I have a feeling I have everyone unmuted, but I remember the last time we tried that people weren't actually unmuted. So let me see.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, hi.
Jane Clark?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, let's. Jane, why don't you go first, and then I think that was Bill.
Yeah.
Okay. Alan Phillips is he was an attorney in North Carolina. I think he's one of the few attorneys in the country that dealt with vaccine exemption rights. He had a long drawn out situation happen with him where his state bar demanded he turn over his attorney-client file, and he refused to do it on the basis that that was privileged and they had no right to see them. They disbarred him, but he does have a website called vaccinerights.com, and he's done vaccine exemptions for years and years and years at the federal level and the state level. But he has a book on there that explains what exemptions are left that you can get as an ebook if you want to go to vaccinerights.com.
Oh, thanks, Jane. Okay. Bill, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just listened to a James Colbert and Catherine Austin Fitz interview. And one of the things that Fitz mentioned is there's a new movement called Currency Friday. And that is the purpose of that is to, you know, head off a little bit at the past the movement to digital currencies by all the monetary institutions. And the practice is essentially on Fridays you pay for everything with coins only. And you may have to get them out of a bank and so on, but do currency and coins to keep the digital devil from the door. And then there is another one unrelated about the graphic novels. I found Will Eisner, a very famous cartoonist in New York. I think his son was the art director at Newsday when I was an editor at Newsday. And the book was, it's the last book that Will Eisner did, and it's called it's in black and white, it's called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, I guess that's just the Learned Elders of Zion, which is a nice companion piece for the 9/11 graphic novel. And that's all I got.
All right, thanks, Bill. Yeah, I did see that that interview about the Cash Friday. That sounded like a good thing to try. Anyone else on either that topic or the vaccine? Yes.
This is Sherry in San Diego.
Does anybody have any, I mean, have you been thinking about when these people that are going to come door to door, what are you going to say to them? When, should you open it or what? I mean, you know, it's, I think I'm kind of scared of this. I don't really know what to do, you know, pretend that you're dead, tell them that the person's dead that used to live here, then get off the list. I don't know, you know.
Well, Sherry, I saw a video of these people going to a neighborhood. I forget what state it was in. It might have been Nevada. I can't remember. But they're dressed in like these yellow T-shirts or green T-shirts, and you know, they have clipboards and all that, so they don't look like military or anything like that. But there was a guy in that neighborhood who harassed them and told them to get out. And I guess it was sort of like a gated community or something that, you know, more of a community than just the, you know, individual houses. And they left. He harassed them so much that they left. So if I can find that video, I'll send it to you. So I think you can just tell them to go away at this point.
Yeah, but then you're going to get on the list. You're going to get on they told me to go away list, you know, and then you're going to be flagged. I think some we got to somehow outsmart them, you know.
Now, can I say something, mm-hmm. Anita?
Yes.
Anita, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, well, Jeffrey Prager and several other people like that have said, you know, Jeffrey Prager was a former DEA agent and DIA agent, so he's done a lot of going to people's houses. And he said, the best thing is to just not answer the door.
Okay.
At all. You don't have to answer the door. But if you happen to, and if you have like a, and if you do answer the door, don't let them put a foot inside the door or something. But he said, you can tell them to get off your property that they're trespassing. And if you're living in an apartment, they don't have a right to stand in front of your door. But the best thing is to tell them that you've been vaccinated and hope that, they don't have a right to ask you for anything because these are volunteers. These are not government officials.
Right.
And they
right.
don't have a warrant. Okay. Now the problem is that they're probably going to come back, but they're less likely to come back. Meaning you're going to get the second wave is going to be Homeland Security and CDC coming back if you're on the list of people who were not vaccinated.
I know. So
if
you
don't tell them if you tell them you're vaccinated, you're less likely to have somebody come back.
Right. I know. You're correct. I think you're right. Yeah, tell them you're vaccinated, or maybe if they come to the door, just like open it a little bit with one of those chains.
No, don't open it at all. You don't have to open your door.
Okay, I would
just
say that.
Don't have to open your door.
If they said, Sherry here, I would say, well, I'm sorry, she was my aunt. She died about 3 months ago. And then maybe they would write down death, like, you know, gone, and maybe that would make them when they go
no,
put
no,
all
no,
that.
No, 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 that's not going to do it. You have to tell them you're vaccinated if you say anything.
Okay.
Or say nothing. Yeah.
What if they ask for proof of that?
They can't.
Yeah.
Because they're not government officials.
Actually, okay. Couldn't one, if they ask if you're vaccinated, can't you assert the HIPAA exception to discussing your medical condition?
These people are not government officials. They don't have a right to anything. They're just volunteers.
Right.
But
HIPAA precludes anyone having to disclose their medical information, so I
then you go on the record as somebody who was uncooperative.
Can
right.
I say something? This is Kathy Allen.
Gary.
So, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm out in California, and I'm really active with my county in terms of, you know, looking at what's going on. First of all, don't answer your door. Second of all, honestly, since nearly half of Americans are choosing not to be vaccinated, I don't lie about my. I don't want to hide. I'm very proud. You know, this is outrageous. There's really going on. So I just don't think it's a good guess about your status. I mean, if I'm asked, I say to whoever's asking me, I'm sorry, I don't choose to give you any of my information, but I'm certainly not going to answer the door to any of these people. I've already gotten kicked out of 2 exercise studios because I live in a small town, and I haven't disclosed my status, but some people know how I feel, and I've been kind of, I don't want to say targeted, but we're getting enough of this in our small communities because in many places you have to show status not to wear a mask, and I refuse to exercise with a mask. So I just want to encourage everybody to be honest. We got to be proud to not be vaccinated, and we have to fight to for our medical freedoms.
You're right.
I had the thought that maybe we ought to start to buy free business cards that say that have the Constitution on them. And remember that part in Article 2 that says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the safety of a free nation, the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. It's a very short amendment, but nobody does the part about or the address of your local well-regulated militia. We probably ought to just, you know, set up P.O. boxes or something for the address of the well-regulated militia in your town, whether you're outgunned or not.
I would encourage all of you to get involved at your local level. In our county, which is Sonoma County, we're very left, probably the most left county, California. It's outrageous. And what we've recently done through Paul Preston in the new California state, which is very constitutionally oriented, we recently served 22 notaries, notarized documents and affidavits to the registrar of our county, to each member of the Board of Supervisors, to our public health officer, basically calling them out on the fraud. And they're not following their oath to adhere to the Constitution. It's a big movement here in California. All counties are serving. And in Napa County, which is right next door to us, of course, many of them aren't taking any of it seriously and aren't responding to our affidavit serving. And when they don't, the sheriff gets served. And just this week, the Napa County sheriff is opening up a criminal investigation towards the registrar for voter fraud, because they didn't follow various voter protocols here in California regarding the ballots and how they should be written. It was all done illegally, and nobody's calling them out on it. So, you know, there are processes you can go through. This is a very scary time for you to work in our particular local jurisdictions and get involved with the people.
Amen.
This is so
pressure locally, yeah. Bonnie, go ahead.
This is Bonnie Faulkner. I'd like to know who was just speaking from Sonoma County.
Bonnie, this is Kathy Allard. I've tried to reach you on about four occasions. I've tried to email you. I'm with Save Our Sonoma.
Yeah.
You may have heard about me. I know you're on my newsletter. We have about four people emails on our newsletter that I am solely in charge of. So we send out notices of any rally, any meetings, any notices that we want to give our community. And I've got so far quite a bit of people on the email listing, but unfortunately only a small handful of people willing to really get involved. It'd be great to meet with you, because I've been trying to reach you, because I know you're here in Glen Ellen, right?
How weird. What's your email?
My email is admin@saveoursonoma.com. And I think I know Craig on Facebook. I hear about what's going on in Canada, which is my heart goes out to him. It's an awful situation, what's happened there. It just seems to be so much worse in Canada.
Admin@saveoursonoma.com. Well, yeah, Canada and Australia look like they're the, were they beta testing this whole thing?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You know, I just.
But I'd love to hear from you. We can have lunch. Actually, my profession is I'm a local psychologist, so I'm really concerned about, you know, of course, all the mental health effects, children, suicides, overdoses, involved. But I was very involved before that. So when this hit, I knew exactly what was coming down. But you all would be amazed at our local psychological association. Basically, I was challenged. Some things being called a racist for doing so. It's just ridiculous. What's happening in our county is that, you know, the minute you start questioning things, you're called a Trump supporter, you're called a racist, and you're canceled. And this is, you know, just completely, of course, it's what you hear on a lot of, you know, sources about what's going on, but we're having it live here. I've been doing my profession for 35 years. I've never seen anything like it with other psychologists are refusing to let patients in their offices without being vaccinated.
Oh.
And, you know, it's outrageous. I think that's illegal. It's discriminatory. It's persecutory.
Oh.
Enabling segregation.
We'll have to get together. What's going on is just absolutely mind-blowing. It's absolutely mind-blowing. I did want to add, now you and several other people, Nita and a few other people, have said don't answer the door. And that's the same kind of advice that I'm getting from somebody I've consulted with. Don't answer the door. Now, she's also
right.
said that she never used to lock her doors during the day. Now she locks her doors because she doesn't want anybody walking in. And according to her, at this point in time, they don't need a warrant to enter your house. This is what she is telling me.
They can just enter your house?
Apparently,
well, only if you open the door. They can't pry open the door.
Wow.
So,
wow, you guys, this is nuts.
Oh, it's really.
You guys, I need to check. I need to go. My husband's got dinner ready. But Bonnie, please email me. I'd love to get together, and we'll see. You've got to talk. If you guys all want to connect in some way, you've got my email.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much for everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other thing, and I'll just throw this out here. I don't know much about it, but I've been told that we're no longer under the Constitution. We're under global governance because of some of the stuff that the United States government has signed with the United Nations. And I have it all in my notes, but I won't go into it now. I don't want to hold everybody up. But this is just extremely, extremely serious.
Biden has asked the UN to do a report on to come into the United States and do a report on our racial discrimination.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Yeah, this is part of their whole. This is whole part of the New World Order, the world.
But that's the first. That's a foot in the door for them.
Yes. Oh my God! What is the name of this? I'll just tell you very quickly the name of this law. Gosh, where the heck is it that the U.S. signed on to in 2005? It's now called traceability, but it was called something else. Anyway, I don't want to hold everybody up. I don't have my notes well enough organized. But, yes, I mean, this is just...
I wouldn't doubt that, Bonnie, that we're actually under a global governance at all.
Health, safety, and welfare. They started talking... Oh, that was in March 2020. Those were the buzzwords. Health, safety, and welfare. Pence talked about health. Who talked about... the WHA talks about... WHO talked about safety, and a panelist talked about welfare, and those are the three buzzwords for the suspension of the Constitution. I mean, oh my God! I wish I could find the name of that law. That the United States, it's a United Nations thing that the U.S. signed on to in 2005. Well, I don't want to. I want to.
Maybe email it to us, Bonnie.
Yeah, why don't I do that? I'll just email it. I don't want to hold everybody up. No, but this is I don't know what to say. Nothing in human history has prepared anybody for this.
Okay. No,
have you guys been following the Corona Investigative Committee and Attorney Reiner Fielmich? He's like kind of the savior. He's really, really working to stop this, and has been interviewing like over a hundred interviews. He just did an interview with James Corbett, and you know, he's really working for us. He's working with Robert Kennedy Jr.
Yeah.
And even with the Lawyers Committee, they've been talking. So he's really good to watch. Reiner Fielmich, he's incredible.
Yeah,
he's like a hope. He's like hope.
Yeah, Sherry, he's doing that, and I know Robert Kennedy Jr. and the organization, I think it's ICAMP, they're suing also. But you know, if you read any of Whitney Webb's articles, she goes deep into all of the intelligence connections, and I don't know
And I think they know these lawsuits are coming, so I think they're moving really swiftly now to, you know, start mandating things before the lawsuits can have any effect. So, you know, I'm happy they're doing the lawsuits, but I just don't know if it's enough at this point.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Well, August is always a year. It's always a time when the government gets us into wars and things, because a lot of people are on vacation that are in positions like editors and the media, and people are not paying attention. So August is always a serious month.
Yeah. There's also,
I'm
glad you mentioned that, Nita. There's also talk of war, yes.
Yeah. So I don't know if any of you saw the World Ivermectin Day. So there's a whole group, I think, out of England that have a website. It's worldivermectinday.com. But they're trying to push the people's knowledge that there is a treatment for COVID, that we don't need the vaccine, to try and, you know, undermine that whole vaccine thing. So that's kind of interesting. I don't know if it'll get anywhere, but their website is World Ivermectin Day, I think it's .com.
There are a lot of these, you know, websites and so on that talk about ivermectin and so on, but I read them and I can't figure out. I just want somebody to tell me, this is where you get it, and this is what it's going to cost, and this is what the dosage is. And I can't find anything that's just simple like that.
Go ahead.
Frontline doctors.
I did. I've looked at it, but it's all very complicated. It doesn't. It's not simple.
No.
And then you have to text them, and I don't text, so I don't know how to do it if I don't text.
No, they have a place there now. I just looked the other day where you can just sign up through the website. You just email them, and you make an appointment with a doctor. You pay $90, and then they'll call you, and they'll send you the prescription for the ivermectin.
Oh, because I looked at it just last week and I couldn't figure it out. It said something about texting them or something.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't see that when I looked. It was yesterday, so.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll look again.
Maybe check it again, too. Yeah.
Because we should all have it on hand.
Yeah. So, well, it's really great to hear
everybody. You're not going to be able to go to a hospital. They're not going to allow you to go into a hospital if you're not vaccinated. That's what Mary Holland was saying tonight on her show.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not going to be able to go anywhere.
When do they anticipate that, like this fall?
Well, she anticipates that they're going to, that they're going to authorize the Pfizer vaccine in August, because they need to authorize these vaccines officially before school begins so that they can mandate them.
Oh.
So it could be any day.
Oh, my God.
But before September 5th or something.
I don't feel like we're at all prepared to deal with, and I don't maybe even have any ideas on how to deal with it, but to deal with what's coming at us, and it's coming fast.
Yeah.
And maybe on our next call we can maybe get a speaker or somebody.
Well, there are also reports that they're setting up camps. I mean, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that worries me.
What was that, Nita?
That there are reports that they're setting up camps for people who are not vaccinated.
Oh, yeah.
Homeland Security.
It's called public reception centers, I think. They're gonna kill people. Well, they
already are. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Oh, my God.
And you know, their agenda is huge. It's big, and they've taken, you know, they're out on a limb kind of with all of this. They're going to do whatever they have to do to make it work for their agenda. So I think we really need to do some strong pushback and not kind of wait and see, you know, but just really start pushing back.
It's a shame that there people, I kept thinking back in March of 2020 when they did the lockdown, I kept wondering, well, where's all the businesses? Where's the Chamber of Commerce? They're just shutting down and they're just going along with it.
This is Sherry. I got kicked off because my Skype credit went away, so I'm back.
Okay.
Where's the ACLU?
Oh, forget it. I mean, now we've got, you know, some great people doing some stuff, but we're like a year and a half into this thing. I feel like it's too little too late.
Well, that's what I think it's going to come down to, the fact that people are armed in this country.
Uh-huh.
But actually, it's hard to see the whole camps being set up and all that going over really well in the 21 states, I believe, that now have constitutional carry, meaning open or concealed carry of firearms by anyone. It seems like the attitude that would support that kind of legislation would completely be opposed to any, kind of mandatory vaccine.
Well, yeah.
Well, I think they're just lying low, those people.
Yeah.
Meaning, I don't know because I'm here in New York City. We don't have that. But my sense is that they're lying low.
Yeah.
Well, what do you guys think is the best state that's being more constitutional that would be safer to live in?
Probably Texas.
Arizona.
I think maybe for us in San Diego, it might be like Baja, to go over into Baja. So maybe there.
We got people from here in Texas, people coming from everywhere to Texas.
You do?
13 to 15% of our sales on the real estate is Californians, and I see New York license plates. I see them from everywhere now.
You need to tell the ones from California that Texas is a mandatory gun possession state. They're not allowed in unless they buy a gun.
We like our guns here. Everybody has one.
Well, if anything saves us, that's what's going to save us.
Yeah.
Well, that's what they're going to come after next, my dear.
Of course. That's what they always do.
They're already talking about it.
So I hope that nobody gives up a single gun.
I don't think they will in Texas.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it could get really wild.
It could get really wild. It could be like the Wild West again.
Well, Catherine Austin Fitz said you need to be prepared to move at least 10 times.
I actually think not. I think the states where there's constitutional carry and that sort of attitude about just the Second Amendment alone, I think that it'll be very unlikely that anyone's going to try to force anything mandatory on those populations. I just can't see that working. But the whole thing is really an exercise in terrorism, because what they've tried to do is frighten enough of the population that part of the population screams out mandatory vaccinations, because they've already gotten them and they're afraid of people that haven't, which it's a form of terrorism, of course.
Well, they don't care about who's coming over the border down here at all.
Right.
Not
exactly.
One bit.
They're like
letting
that.
People come left and right, and they've 10% of them at least have got COVID. So
yes.
They don't. They really want to hurt Texas. I'm telling you.
Oh yes, absolutely,
clear.
Jane. That's absolutely.
And that
right.
Shows that the motivation is control, not safety.
Oh, of
exactly.
Course.
Exactly. Exactly.
Of course. Of course.
Well, that's
no
the problem with Texas. Look at what they did with the weather. A few months ago.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know what's going to happen anyplace because they're using all kinds of...
We never did that stuff.
Yeah.
That was a real oddball.
There is also a mass exodus from the United States over the border down here, because I was looking at what places rent for over down Rosarito Beach and just, over the border here, and it's gone up astronomically. So a lot of people are going into Mexico.
Interesting. Sure.
Oh, yeah.
What are Mexico's laws on COVID? Are they
The president, I was proud of him at first, but then he succumbed. He claimed that he had COVID so that he had the T cell immunity. And I thought, and he wasn't going to get the vaccine, nor was he going to mandate it. So I thought, cool, that's great. And then now I researched it again, and he did succumb after all, but he's still not mandating it so far.
What are they doing in Sweden? Where they didn't mask and they said we'll just develop herd immunity on our own. Have they accepted any vaccines in Sweden?
They have, yeah.
Okay, I haven't followed Sweden in the news very much, but
I think they're not mandating them, but they're recommending them. I mean, listen,
right?
Trump recommended the vaccine.
They refuse to lock
Trump
down.
Trump is the one person who could get people out there in droves against this, but he recommended it.
Yeah.
Trump, in a way, the way he he put up with being kicked off of even Twitter while he was still president. Yeah. Sort of set very
Trump
bad.
Called on people to rise up against this vaccine. He could get millions of people out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Trump has never he's never spoken out against. Has he spoken out against mandatory vaccine or against the vaccine?
He's against
at all.
Mandatory. He's against mandatory, but he's for the vaccine. He recommends the vaccine. But
he's
not
the one
mandatory.
Operation Warp Speed.
Right.
That the military give it to us. That's what he said.
But he said it was. He didn't recommend. He didn't want it to be mandatory. But he does recommend it.
I think
correct.
That Mexico makes ivermectin available, is what I've heard.
Well, the frontline doctors, if you get a hold of their website, frontlinedoctorsmustbe.org or .com, then you can go on a drop down and you give them your email. They email you, and then it's $90, and you get a prescription of ivermectin mailed to you. I haven't done it yet, but I did get that.
Well, it costs a lot more than that. It's a very cheap drug, but they're charging a lot.
I
know people that have paid a doctor, and then they go to get a prescription, and it's like $400 or $500, and maybe your insurance will pay for half of it. It's supposed to be a very cheap drug, and of course they're making it very expensive.
Well, you can get it from the veterinarian. It's a horse dewormer.
Right.
Amazon's got it online. You can buy it off Amazon for for the horse for $12.
Yeah, but what's the dosage? What's the dosage?
Well, the dosage on there is for a 1,200-pound horse. So
okay.
If you're 200 pounds, you just divide it by 6 and take
okay.
it.
Okay.
That's why
I understand it's a paste. It's a paste.
Yeah, it's a paste. I don't think it's going to hurt you.
No.
I heard Sherry Tenpenny say that she takes a few pills a week as kind of a preventive because she's been doing a lot of flying and stuff. You know, Sherry Tenpenny's really been speaking up.
It works.
Well, the other thing to take, Dr. Zelenko, who sort of pioneered the whole thing about hydroxychloroquine, he said if you can't get hydroxychloroquine, quercetin is almost as good.
Yeah, that's what Dr. Merrill Nass said. Just take quercetin.
So I'm taking quercetin every day, but I don't know how much to take.
Where did you get it?
Oh, it's just a supplement. You can get it at anywhere. Any place that sells
quercetin.
Supplements.
I'm sorry. I was thinking of hydroxychloroquine.
No, quercetin.
Well, yeah. Quercetin is a natural, Dr. Nass said, natural substitute for hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah, and you take it with the zinc, which is a hydrophore.
Actually, I am taking quercetin.
Vitamin C, vitamin D, 3.
What strength of quercetin do you take?
Well, I just take one pill a day, which I think is 1,000 units, but, but I'm probably, if you actually get COVID, you have to take a lot more. And the other thing I do is colloidal silver.
I make my own colloidal silver.
The problem with colloidal
silver. It's a lot of fun to make it, too. I like making it fun.
The warning about colloidal silver that I've had is that it has metals, okay? And it's unclear how that's going to react. They're putting up 5G and they're going to 6G. And also the metals, there's a metal component in these shots that they're giving people. So you generally speaking want to stay away from metals. It's a question mark is all I'm saying.
No, I hear you. That's what I'm saying. I'd like to get something really simple that covers all of this just in, two paragraphs.
So you had COVID, and I've got a list of what I took, and I didn't have any trouble. Y'all want it.
Yes. Why don't you... Jane, would you send it to us?
Okay, well, who can I send it to that can send it out to everybody else's? I've got Bonnie, I've got your email, but I don't have anybody else's.
If you send it to me, Jane, and I'll send it out. This is Cheryl.
Okay. Is this Sherry?
Do you have my, do you want me to give it to you?
Why don't you take mine down?
Okay.
JaneClarkAttorney@gmail.com. And I'll just send it. You can send it to everybody because I took it. I researched it since February of 2020, multiple doctors, and I've got a list of what you can do.
Oh, good, okay. good.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. Yeah.
Budesonide is something for the lungs.
Thank you.
Yeah, so just
Has anyone seen the information, the study the Spanish did, some Spanish scientist on graphene oxide being in the vaccine?
Yeah.
I saw
That's another concern.
I saw it. I think that there are different concoctions for different areas of our world. I don't think everybody's getting the same stuff. I think
that's
some
right.
people might even be getting a placebo.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I do too.
Yeah, you could be right.
Because you think of having to keep it at that, 70 below zero or something? I mean, how could these mobile vans and everything be doing all of that?
That's right.
Actually, you just reminded me of one of the great answers to give the person at the door, which is that, oh, I had the placebo shot. I'm in the control group. which means I'm in the study. You can't give me the real shot. Yeah. It'll screw up the study. Yeah.
But they say graphene is in the masks too. So
yes.
Yeah. And in those swabs, those tests
and the
are
swabs,
good. Yeah.
And in the swabs, yeah.
Because that was proven that not one of those tests, which are all modeled. Totally off, you know, Carrie Mullis's model, but recycled so high creates false positives. Mm-hmm. That means that
they're removing that test by the end of the year. The CDC has already announced it, but they'll probably put in something worse, you know.
Okay.
I just saw an article where they're doing the CDC themselves has made a new PCR test that's coming online.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So maybe that one has the vaccine in it, you know.
Right.
Maybe. Oh God. Or they didn't want competition.
You know, because with chickens, they can vaccinate them, and you know, and then the chickens actually spread the vaccine to other chickens. They've been using that for several years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And see, then when they get the satellites up and they get 6G up there, apparently 5G is only transitory. They got to go to 6G, and then they can read the data within people from the shots. Yeah. I mean,
is that true?
Yes. That's the whole thing. Do you remember that old? I used to pitch it on KPFA. There was a movie called Zeitgeist. Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
And within that, there was a snippet from an interview with that guy Rousseau. What was his name? Anyway, he was friends with one of the...
Aaron Rousseau, right?
Aaron Rousseau. And then he died not long after that, suspiciously of cancer. But anyway, he had been good friends with one of the Rockefellers, who predicted 9/11. He said, pretty soon you're going to be seeing soldiers going into caves in Afghanistan. But anyway, Rousseau said to this guy, well, what's the point? What's the end game? Where are you going with that? And he said, we want to get everybody in the world chipped.
Yeah. That was Nicholas Rockefeller.
Yes, yes. And it's happening.
And it's happening. I know.
Yeah.
So scary.
Maybe Afghanistan is where we need to go now that we're pulling our troops out.
That's
a good place.
Probably the best place to go.
to a country with no oil. That's the best thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was down at the harbor the other day and I saw a whole bunch of boats, and those boats look really tempting to get on a boat and just head out to sea.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good idea.
Cheryl, can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Has Christopher Boyan ever spoken on the conference call over the years? And
Yes, he has. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a recording available of that, I presume.
Yes, if you go to Craig's website, which is truthandshadows.com, I think, or is that old? Yeah.
I
can't remember when it was. It was 3 or 4 years
September
ago now.
September or October 2019.
Great. Does anybody know how to get in touch with him or where he might be currently?
I have his email. I have an old phone number. He stayed at my house before when he came to San Diego. But I do have his email. I've been wondering. That's funny you should think of him. Because I've been thinking about him. We haven't heard from him in a long time.
No.
Well, I thought I sent an email to Dave Beiswinkle of the Lawyers Committee because I think he's certainly, if they're willing to have a speaker who goes to the who did it and why issues, he would be the optimal person to have on.
The Lawyers Committee's not willing to do that. They're not willing to do that.
Oh, that's a bad sign.
Well, it isn't because they have to remain pure to their goal of proving that explosives blew up the World Trade Center. And they can't stray out of that paradigm right there for now.
All right. Well, but the Lawyers Committee doesn't have to endorse what Boleyn is saying. I mean, you know, the Lawyers Committee, I know they stick close to the 8-9-11 truth, you know, sticking to the facts of, like, you know, the science of issues. But there's no reason that there can't be a 9-11 conference on the 20th anniversary that actually puts out there the best evidence that already has been collected explaining who did it and why, as opposed to perpetually asking the government to create an investigation and tell us that, because, well, the government hasn't done that for 100 years. So anyway, I'm sorry, can you text or email me with that contact information for...
I have an email for him. I should be glad to.
Just for everybody's information, for everybody's information, the last time that Christopher was on our call was October 30th, 2019. So you can actually go to you can go to my website and you can see, if you just kind of, scroll down to that date, you'll see I've got his last name in brackets there, so you know that he was one of the speakers.
Yeah, I wanted to connect him with the French author, Laurent Guyonneau, who I mentioned earlier. I apologize for going over with my discussion with the speaker. But, that's why I'd like to try to reach out for him wherever he might be.
I'm sure they're already in touch with each other.
Yeah.
No, let me just did you ask for my email or?
Yes, I'm ready to write. Tell me now.
Okay, my first name and my last name, Carl, K-A-R-L, G-O-L-O-V, like Victor, I-N, at gmail.com.
Okay, great. I'll get it right to you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Okay.
But anyway, Cheryl, this is Anita again. I'm terrified at what's coming. I don't know what to do.
Me too.
That's how I feel.
Because it's like we can just disappear.
Right. Yeah. We can't. And no, I don't think any of us are really prepared for this because we never thought it would happen this quickly. You know.
No.
So, and what's really hard is I have a daughter who's going to have a baby in 2 months. And she's got a 2-year-old, and she is so in, she won't listen to me anymore. She says, Mom, I don't want to be your audience. And I said, Kelly, I know that. I'm worried about you, you know. And so she thinks that's like I'm the conspiracy person. She's not getting vaccinated, and she didn't vaccinate my grandson either at all. So she is anti-vaccination, so she's smart about that, but I don't think she could bear it right now, you know? So I don't know how to get through to them, and that's what's so hard. If it was just me by myself, then I'd probably escape down to Mexico and live, in a little hut down on the beach and spear fish or something. But I can't leave them, you know? And how do you protect somebody that doesn't want to be protected because they're in cognitive dissonance? It's a psyop, like out of this world is what this is.
Amazing
psyop.
And I think we're all in that position, Sherry, where some family members or friends just don't get it, and it really disrupts the relationship and puts a big block.
And then the little babies, I'm fighting for my grandkids. So I joined the Children's Defense Fund here in San Diego, and those moms, I'm helping with them And then there's Open San Diego, which is real voicing, you know. I went down to the Board of Supervisors and spoke there. And there's some good, there's a hot attorney. Her name is Leigh Dundas. Have you heard her? She's a public rights attorney in Orange County. You should hear her talk to the Board of Supervisors. She's like uplifting. I listened to it 5 times just to get motivated, you know. She talks so fast and so articulate because they only give you a few minutes to talk to the Board of Supervisors, and she really calls them out. And they did prevent having vaccine clinics set up in Orange County at the elementary schools, because that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to vaccinate the kids without even the parents knowing.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what people are going to have to do is they're going to have to say, okay, my employer insisted that I had that, or someone is forcing me to get this vaccine. I can't sue the pharmaceutical company, so I'm going to sue you that forced me to get it to keep my job. I think people are going to have to start doing that with county officials or whatever. I don't know what kind of immunity they're going to pull out of their hat, but I think.
But Jane, did you see today that I think it was the Supreme Court just ruled that businesses have the right to mandate vaccines.
And the government, too. Well, it's the DOJ. The DOJ ruled.
Yeah, okay.
It was a Houston case. Yeah, I know it was a Houston case that got appealed. And I have not seen that ruling yet, but
the DOJ ruled that mandates are okay for the federal government and for businesses. So they all federal employees now have to get vaccinated.
Well, I suppose one might lose their job by challenging that and taking it to the Supreme Court, but eventually the federal court system, the Supreme Court, will have to weigh in on that issue.
Well, no, they can say you don't have standing. I mean,
right? Of course they can. Yeah.
Well, the Supreme Court doesn't hear too many cases.
They're not hearing anything of relevance these days.
Right. They're all part of. That's
they're
true.
All afraid. Are they all afraid?
Okay, is this the DOJ, was this a statement, or was this a position they have on a case?
It's a position that they took, but of course they don't make legislation, so how could they do that? But they do,
well,
they do,
I mean,
it anyway.
Yeah, well, there's a case out of Houston that essentially said you have a right to, for a nurse and a group of the medical providers, you have a right to change employers if you don't like it. It just came out 2 months ago. So I don't know what the DOJ is talking about, but that case right now is on appeal, I know.
Well, the reason is that's why they're going to approve the vaccine so that it can be mandated.
Yeah, this was just in the morning paper here. They said it was they ruled that it was okay. So,
yeah.
Well, but I mean, are we talking about the Department of Justice for their people?
The Department of Justice,
are
we talking about
who? Who? Because that case in Houston is still on appeal. It hasn't been decided yet.
There must be another case then that they're talking about.
How can they impose on someone who asserts a religious exemption?
That's Alan Phillips. It's vaccinerights.com, and he said that's probably one of your best bets is religious exemption.
Connecticut has got
In New York, they don't recognize religious exemptions for anything.
I think that's being challenged, isn't it?
Yeah, but, I mean, in the meanwhile, they're not recognizing it.
Right.
I mean, these court cases take years. Like Cheryl said, we don't have years.
No, we
and
don't.
You know what? They're at 11,405 deaths on bears as of July 16th. Now, that's supposedly only 1% reported, right? So, I mean, we're up over 100,000 or more deaths. Now, they've ended vaccines for only 57 deaths, being too risky. You know, what's wrong with people? Don't they see that this is definitely a genocidal situation? And it's amazing. You know,
I think it has to do with population control and these population control groups. I really do.
Oh, it is. That's what Reiner Fielmick says, too. He says that's what it is. That's what Dr. Peter McCullough says. He says
that's what it's looking like to me.
Jim Mars has got a book on population control, and I'm sure he would be really piping in right now if he was still alive.
I mean, yeah. For 11,405 deaths on bears, and Robert Kennedy says he's got proof that that they've been going in and changing this bears and messing with it to reduce the deaths to be illnesses. They've seen that happen on this reporting. So, right. But even this is way too many deaths, you know.
Well, most of the side effects and the deaths are not reported.
Right.
Apparently,
exactly.
It's very difficult
exactly.
to
Someone,
use that their system.
Right.
They're not reporting them.
Only 1% reported.
Mm-hmm.
So add 99%, we're over 100,000 deaths, you know, and that's conservative.
Right.
I mean, they're giving it to pregnant mothers. And then there has been thousands of transmissions of reports of transmission from the injected to the non-injected.
Yes.
There have been several reports about that as well. And so that's for hormonal damage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some doctors
will let
a vaccinated person in the office.
Well, they're talking about that all this vaccination has actually caused the like the Delta and whatever, has caused those to spin off of the vaccinating itself.
Mm-hmm.
Has caused the variants because of the vaccination.
Well, Peter McCullough doesn't know such thing as variants at all, that the variants, there's not been one report written on a variant, that that's just to get you to take more boosters. There's no such thing as a variant. That's baloney. So, I mean, and those PCR tests, you know, that's the whole house of cards.
Well, what I noticed is flu just kind of seemed to disappear.
Right.
So did cancer.
It disappeared. I mean, my God, where'd it go?
All the deaths, everything went down, except
mm-hmm.
for COVID.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about y'all. I don't take the flu vaccines either.
No.
No, no.
No, I never have.
No.
Mm-mm.
Mm.
Well,
yeah,
I gotta go.
It's
10 o'clock here, so y'all enjoy yourself, and I sure appreciate everybody's comments.
Yeah, thank you very much, everybody.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank everyone, and I appreciate that conversation.
Cheryl.
Yes. Cheryl and everybody. Goodbye, Bonnie.
Cheryl.
Oh, yes. Bye, Nita. Thank you.
Don't answer the door.
Just a quick note, Cheryl.
Doors. Oh,
yes,
you're also not supposed to talk to them. Don't talk to them.
Okay.
You don't talk to them, and you can also film them and take their picture and get
yeah,
their license
that's a good,
plate.
Yeah, you're supposed to film them, and if they have a license plate, you know,
yes,
take
yes,
that.
Yes.
Yeah, it might be a good idea to get one of those little outdoor, those cheap little outdoor cameras maybe. You could press a button and film them.
Right.
And you can see, you know, you can say all people who enter this porch will be sprayed with arsenic. Get out. You know.
Just get a German Shepherd. And leave him tied up by the front door.
I know. A couple of tarantulas sitting there.
All right, everyone. Well, good here. Good me being with you all and talking. See you next month.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.